I think we're, I don't know what we're doing. Ready? The Economic Development Budget Division for Wednesday, March 14th will come to order. Are you ready, Senator Chaudhry? An FYI, Senator Chaudhry's bill is not officially in front of the committee, so we won't be able to do any amendments or take any official action on it, but it is here for information because we might end up having to put it in our bill. So, Senator Chaudhry, go ahead and give us an explanation.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This bill sets up a certification process for independent contractors or 1099 employees. We do this because of the problem that has been occurring within the construction industry, and this bill would only apply to the construction industry with misclassification of improper misclassification of employees. That misclassification occurs when workers who should be W-2 employees, they earn a wage or a salary, and then they get a W-2 at the end of the year. Are instead illegally declared 1099 independent contractors. What this ends up doing is avoiding certain taxes, certain insurance obligations at a reduced cost to the employer. So it ends up putting legitimate businesses at a competitive disadvantage. And it also cheats the state out of millions of dollars in revenue, actually hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. It shifts financial and other risks onto workers. It dumps costs onto hospitals, insurers, competitors, and the taxpayers. And it opens the door for additional illegal activities such as wage and hour violations and the use of undocumented workers. The evidence suggests that illegal misclassification is growing more rampant nationwide. Companies that misclassify do it a lot because the advantages easily outweigh the risks. Our laws are clear that this is illegal, but enforcement is another matter. And so what we're doing to create these certificates for construction independent contractors is create a link to tracking independent contractors, and in theory then we can cross-reference those people with the amount of taxes and insurance and other requirements for those legitimate employees. With me today is Kyle Macarius with the Carpenters Union.
Now, welcome to the committee. Do you want to testify?
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is Kyle Macarius. I'm the political director of the Lakes and Plains Regional Council of Carpenters. Appreciate your consideration this morning of Senate File 1103. This bill was developed in consultation between our union, employers, and the Department of Labor and Industry. It's a good bill that will make a significant difference towards fixing this problem in the construction industry. Here's how the mechanism will work. Independent contractors who operate in the construction industry will register with the Department of Labor and Industry and pay a $150 fee. They will sign a document that certifies, under penalty of a fine, that they meet the test to be their own legitimate business. Approved, they will receive a certificate allowing them to operate as an independent contractor. The certificate will have to be renewed every 2 years. Contractors wishing to hire independent contractors will have to verify that the independent has this certificate, and contractors who don't do this or who coerce employees to filing for the certificate will be subject to fines. And most importantly, the Commissioner of Labor will share this information with the Department of Revenue, so the threat of a tax audit hangs over potential cheaters. I believe the sections of this bill specifically relevant to this committee involve the $150 fee, and I also believe that someone from the department may want to talk about the bill as well. I would be glad to stand for any questions, Mr. Chair, or go into greater detail about any section of the bill.
Are there any questions from the committee? Is there anybody else who wants to comment? And
I think the department would like to talk about this a little. The language was developed in concert with the department they've come to us this afternoon and talked about some potential costs that they might incur that they would like to talk about.
Who is here from the department?
Hello, I'm Nancy Lepink, L-E-P-P-I-N-K, and I'm general counsel for the Department of Labor and Industry. In terms of costs, it's the expectation that the way that we've sequenced the effective date of this bill, that with a what the substantive language of the bill provides is that it the new definition or the new requirements to be an independent contractor would go into effect as of January 1, 2009. The bill would go into effect July 1, 2008. Rulemaking authority would go into effect immediately after enactment. What that would do is allow for the agency to get rules in place, hopefully prior to July 1, 2008. Then there would be a six-month window for individuals to apply and obtain the independent contractor certificate, with then the new provision going into effect, the new requirement to be an independent contractor going into effect in January. I'm not sure that that language is in the Senate bill, but it is in the it's in the House bill. The plan is that the fee for applying for the exemption certificate would cover the costs as of the effective date of the bill, but the department would need some startup money to get rulemaking done, to get particular IT needs in place, and to basically get the program ready to accept applications on that July 1, 2008 effective date. I don't know exactly what those costs would be. The agency would like to have the opportunity to prepare a fiscal note. Controversial rulemaking can cost in between $100,000 and $200,000, and then there would be staff needs associated with that. So, and this may or may not, I can't anticipate whether rulemaking would be controversial or not. Possibly not, and then of course the cost would be lost because there wouldn't be a need for an administrative hearing on the rules. I'm sort of not certain what it would be. I guess I would say less than $500,000, probably more than $250,000, but I don't know
Sure. You think I'm made out of money here or what?
What?
You think I'm made out of money here?
I think that's your entire target, isn't it, Mr. Chair?
Senator Kubley.
But I have no idea. No. I guess I'd do better. I prefer to have our chief financial officer work with the program person to come up with the what the cost would be.
Well, that's fine because we don't officially have the bill before us today.
Yes, so, I realize that. So,
Senator
we
Kubley.
Can do that.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Lepink. Just could we have your opinion on whether the provisions of this bill would be easier to enforce than what is currently in place for independent contractors?
Yes, and the reason that I say that, Chairman Tomasoni, Senator Kubley, is that what this bill does, it requires an individual to proactively declare themselves as an independent contractor, and then to proceed to work in have a work situation that's consistent with being an independent contractor. Where some of the concerns that occur in the workplace now is where individuals, you know, only after they've fallen from the roof find out that the company they're working for thinks they're an independent contractor, or where you have practices where employers basically one day declare you to be an independent contractor or have you sign documentation that's where you basically agree to be an independent contractor. So consequently, what the primary focus of this bill will be to remove that practice from the scene in this industry. And basically, to be an independent contractor, you individually will have to have proactively opted yourself out of the employment as the first step. Then, of course, the second step, of course, means that you still have to continue to the work relationship has to be consistent with that of an independent contractor, too.
Well, Mr. Chair and Ms. Leppington, so what I'm hearing you say is that it would protect the worker because there would be no one going to work for a contractor then who doesn't understand that they would not be covered by other company benefits. Is that correct? Or that they'd be on their own to provide their own benefits?
Ms. Levy.
The person's going to know when they walk into that work situation that whether or not they're an employee.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Quigley, that is just one of the benefits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the significant one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Any Senator Metzen?
How come, maybe I'm missing something here, but we need $500,000 to develop the rule maker stuff. I mean, we've got the departments in place. And I think we're paying people already. And we've got the administrative hearing judges. They're there doing their work. I mean, Mr. Chairman, I am just not clear why every time we and it's a mandate, I understand, that they have to do some work. Maybe I'm making just a broad statement here.
Excuse
I thought
me,
I heard
Senator.
You say that. But why do we have to, as a legislature, always add on $500,000 here and $500,000 there? But it seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong on this, there's people on board. Hopefully they're paid to do some of these things, or am I just off on this one? I've been off before, but then.
No.
Actually, I'm 0-2 today on my bill, so I'm not having a very good day. But does it always take money, I guess, is it? And your departments have a lot, not a lot, but they get doled out, you know.
Chairman Tomasoni, Senator Metzen. I'm really not the finance person, and I could be way off in the number that I gave you. But to answer your more specific question, yes, the department, you know, does have staff to a degree that could absorb some of this work. There would be some things that would, though, be unique potentially to this effort, which would the department is, when it does a rulemaking, it incurs costs, including Office of Administrative Hearing costs, but also to the extent that any technology or programming would need to be done, et cetera, those would be costs that would be incurred. Now, those would be one-time costs. This is not going to be these would not be ongoing costs, but certainly the department is not looking to obtain any more money than would absolutely be necessary. And so,
Chairman, just
Senator Metzen.
I mean, you got things around here in this committee, like, and we've all been hearing the stories and the homeless, brownfields we got to clean up, and the list goes on and on and on. And $500,000 to do something in just a couple of those areas I mentioned, and I could name 10 more that you're listening to and our committee is that are, but end of my sermon, but find the money on some of these things, I think.
Senator Chaudhry, to that point. We have a finance officer here, if she wants.
Sure. The money person's here.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. On what Senator Metzen said, not my experience that we've had to attach an appropriation to a rulemaking that we require in the statute.
Yeah. I like your legislation, Mr. Chairman.
It's not my experience. In fact, I chair the Environment Committee. We oversee the PCA and the DNR and lots of rulemaking legislation. We haven't had one
ask for
appropriation, or have I ever seen one, frankly.
Ms. Farrell.
Rulemaking, we're going to have $100,000 with that to pay for it. We just don't do that.
Thank you.
Nor have I seen, you know, computer IT costs associated with anything that we ask the departments to do. So it's certainly their prerogative to want to examine the fiscal impact of it, but I haven't seen that.
We're down to free then.
Well, Mr. Chair, up until 10 minutes ago, it was.
Okay, Ms. Farrell.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Cindy Farrell, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the department. I think one important point was missed in the discussion, and the talk about the costs, the one-time costs associated with getting this program up and running, is there will be ongoing revenue from this $150 fee as well. And I have not done an analysis of the bill. And depending on when the effective date actually is that we start receiving that money, that could be between $1 to $2 million per year that would likely be available to the general fund and your committee for whatever purposes you desire.
Mr. Chair, perhaps in their fiscal analysis department could discuss how we could adjust the enacting dates so that the fee can make the program pay for itself, even the startups. I think we could figure something out where it does that.
Yeah, I think so. Senator Fischbach, did you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think I got it answered, but we're going to get a fiscal note.
We're going to work on that, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any further comments from the committee? Anybody else want to comment on the bill? Okay. Thank you, Senator Shaw.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Is Senator Clark here? Senator Torres Ray stood up. You get to come to the table then. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee. This is my first time before your committee, and I really appreciate that you're giving me the time to present my bill.
We do have a tradition here that the first time a freshman comes before the committee, they're supposed to buy a round the next time you see us. So.
I hope there is a tradition that you will vote for my bill as well. So.
Not bad.
Thank you.
She could be a ranger, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. I have a handout that I would like to pass around. If the staff could do that for us, we would really appreciate it. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you again for giving me this opportunity. Before I start, I have a verbal amendment that I need to introduce, and I would appreciate a member support in doing so. And it's a technical agreement just to fix the language to put the bill in the form that I need for this discussion. And it's just to delete the word added to and insert the words for the housing trust fund, and I believe you have the language before you, and if not, please let me know if that has been distributed.
Are you talking about line 1.8?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
So repeat it for council, please, Senator.
Again, it's to delete the words added to, that's in line 1.8, and add the words for the housing trust fund, because it was not clear, and so we were the recommendation was that we actually add this language.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that doesn't make sense. For the housing trust fund to the agency's base. Did I read right? The appropriation. Senator Metzen moves that line 1.8 to delete added to and insert for the housing trust fund. I need another word. of the agency for the housing trust fund of. Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Almost adopted.
I don't
okay.
think that's right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am here to ask for your support for Senate File 1569. This bill will appropriate $15 million in from the general fund above the governor's proposed budget for 2008-2009. This money will be appropriated to the commissioner of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency for the Housing Trust Fund account. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm here to ask for your support. These subsidies will be distributed among the lowest income families in the state of Minnesota. And what we're hoping to accomplish with this is to help the state of Minnesota keep pace with the state's plan to end long-term homelessness. And we feel very strongly that these investments need to be made in order to support these families. And if, with your support, we will be able to address key areas in housing related to capital, operating, and supporting services. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I have Mr. Stone with me, who will be able to present more information to you and also respond to some of the questions you may have related to House File 1569.
Welcome, Mr. Stone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is George Stone. I am the program director for the Corporation for Supportive Housing Minnesota program. Thank you for inviting me here today to speak in support of Senate File 1569, an increase to the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency Housing Trust Fund. I realize we have a short amount of time. I also realize you've heard a number of people come before you and address issues of homelessness. That's a good thing. I'd like to start by just saying a few words about the Housing Trust Fund request. In order, as Senator Torres Ray mentioned, in order to keep pace with the state's plan to end long-term homelessness, as well as to support the other critical affordable housing needs in our state, an investment of $37 million in the Housing Trust Fund is needed. The affordable housing community has been very pleased with what the governor has proposed in his affordable housing budget. However, as an affordable housing community, we are also seeking an additional $15 million to his request for the Housing Trust Fund for the next biennium. A little bit of background on the program itself. The Housing Trust Fund was established by the legislature in 1988, and it was put in place to support capital development needs for affordable housing for low-income persons and families. Later, it was expanded to provide funding for rental assistance and operating support for the agency's developments. And in 2005, the Housing Trust Fund rules were modified to add a funding priority for developments and programs that serve households experiencing long-term homelessness in correlation with the state's plan to end long-term homelessness. These funds can be used for rental assistance, operating subsidies, construction, acquisition, preservation, rehab, and rehab of affordable housing and permanent supportive housing. It's the state's goal to end long-term homelessness by 2010 in Minnesota by providing housing and supportive services to 4,000 households experiencing long-term homelessness. Virtually all of the households will need some sort of operating support, a subsidy, or rental assistance, whether it's project-based, tied to the buildings themselves, or attached to the tenants. The state's made significant progress in meeting its goals on this state plan, and in 2006 were 91 units ahead of schedule. There's much work to be done, however, and I brought along with me today, I know we don't have a lot of time, but I thought it'd be more interesting, rather than hearing from someone like myself who works in the industry, from a practitioner of a program who delivers these subsidies and a recipient of the subsidies herself to talk about how this program has benefited her life. So first I'd like to introduce Mikkel Beckman with St. Stephen's Human Services.
Mr. Beckman, welcome.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you very much for your time today. My name is Mikkel Beckman. I'm the executive director of St. Stephen's Human Services. I have been working in homeless shelters and on the streets and in programs with homeless people for 17 years. And I must say that just on a personal observation over those 17 years, I've not been as hopeful about ending homelessness as I have been the last couple of years with leadership from the governor and from the Senate and House of Representatives, as well as from the federal government and at the local level. There seems to be a unique alignment around this issue. St. Stephen's Human Services has received the Housing Trust Fund subsidies from the state of Minnesota's Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. We began receiving them 2 years ago. And our focus is on working with people who have been on the streets or homeless for a very long period of time. And the program has been a miracle for the people we work with. Nothing can begin in a person's life until they have a place to live. People don't make changes on the streets. And life is very challenging for folks, and everything begins with housing. Housing's not the ending, it's the beginning. It has been our experience that just in a couple of levels that the Housing Trust Fund subsidies have been the key component in our work to end homelessness, which is our mission. I would say for a couple of things, not only for the recipients, of which you'll hear from somebody here who's been the recipient of the subsidy, but in general for taxpayers, this program saves a lot of money. It costs a family, it costs county taxpayers in my community over $3,500 a month to keep a family in a shelter. And our average subsidy, as you can see, I prepared a handout for you, of $500 can support that family in their own place. And so we feel that for pennies on the dollar, this has been a very effective program. It's moved quite a few people off the streets. With the governor's focus on ending long-term homelessness, we launched a program for people who had been homeless a minimum of 8 years. These folks are all receiving the housing subsidy, and I must say that the results have been remarkable. We've seen a vast reduction in the use of emergency services. We have seen people stabilize in their own housing, and we have seen people begin to reintegrate back into the community. And these are folks, again, who have been out there for a very, very long time. I've got some demographic information here on the sheet, but I think at this point I will turn it over to one of the recipients.
This is Adrienne Velasquez. Yep. If you could please introduce yourself. Know who you are.
Okay. My name is Adrienne Velasquez, and bear with me, I'm not very good with this. But
you'll be fine.
Okay. Since the program, I heard of the program through the HA, and they've helped me pay rent, 70% of my rent, and it has allowed me to do a lot more things that I haven't been able to do. I've been homeless for like more than 5 years. And now I can say that it has given me a chance to get back in touch with my family. Being homeless, I haven't been able to speak with my children and my mom and dad. And I mean, the best thing that I can say, it's given me a second chance in life. I don't know what else to say, but that's pretty much what it's done for me.
That works.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just have a couple of closing remarks that I would like to make, and then I'd be happy to answer questions you may have. In the packet, you will also find a couple of other pieces of information. On one side, you'll find letters of support. I've included these to represent the geographic breadth to which the program has its reach. As Mikkel Beckman mentioned, St. Stephen's does a lot of their work in Senator Torres Rey's district. However, there are programs here representing St. Cloud, representing the Northeast, representing the South and Southeast of Minnesota. These regions have all benefited from this program and would continue to do so if the program were to expand. Also, I would just like to say that, again, it's a very important message that I get through that the affordable housing budget that was presented it needs to be supported in all aspects. We're very supportive of it, including in this housing trust fund, and we would hate to see those budgets compromised in any way to support this budget. We want to see this in addition to what's been proposed by the governor. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Jensen, what is the governor's base proposal on this?
Mr. Chairman, members, it's $22,110,000.
Yeah.
Well, this recommendation would be $37,110,000.
And about 75% of the people that receive help are in less than $20,000. Is that about right?
I don't have the demographic information from the agency, but I certainly get that information to the committee as soon as possible.
I think that's right.
I think that is the overall. Certainly those receiving it through the plan to end long-term homelessness are among the lowest income in the state.
Are there any comments from the committee? Questions? Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I think this is a great effort here, and I support your effort. My question would be, if the governor is going to allocate $22 million then how would the additional funds be used, and will you be able to actually make good use of them immediately, or is this something that's going to be needed over time? And some kind of a plan for the use of these funds would be very helpful for us before we go forward in the Senate to talk about why we want to use these funds and how they'll be immediately used in the communities.
Mr. Stone, Senator.
Thank you, Senator Orman. Absolutely. I think that's the intent. And I think part of the problem that we have in Minnesota is the incredible growth of homelessness in the state and how we need additional funding to keep up with the pace. And I think that's where we are having some problems, and we're hoping that with some increase that we could support here, we could make a difference. But the intent is certainly to use these dollars as efficiently and as quickly as we possibly can. And, you know, like the people who testified before you, we see a lot of progress with people who are able to receive funding and support early so they can move on and you know, get stable jobs and continue to provide, you know, for themselves and get houses or whatever they need to do to move on to economic stability.
But Mr. Chair, Senator Orr, members of the committee, I may have a bias because I work in affordable housing, but I think the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency is perhaps one of the most efficient users of the appropriations that they receive from the legislature. They have maximized the source of funding and been able to squeeze as many housing opportunities out of the amounts of appropriations they've received to date. I've spoken with each of the agencies that have submitted their letters of support, asking them if more funding were available, would more people be able to be served through your program? All of them have said, indeed, yes, we would take as many as you had available. So in terms of what that next step is, I think you're absolutely right about long-term sustainability. And, you know, I think it's something we ought to be looking at in terms of the 2010-2011 base funding for this program. It certainly should be maintained and perhaps needs to be considered in terms of elevated. But I know if this funding were made available, the agency would make prudent use of it, and the agencies would be able to put it to use.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your responses. My question is, $20 million from the governor, $10 million additional, $30 million additional, $20, $50. Can you provide some kind of plan for how you're going to use the funds and distribute it? I'm very supportive. Please don't get me wrong. I'm incredibly supportive of what you want to do. I just want to see how those funds will be used and distributed and what the overall plan is, because I'd like to think that we're going to allocate enough to end homelessness. Are we close? Are we far away? And so those kinds of quantifications will help me with this bill. I'm not opposed. Sure. Please understand, I support you. I'd like to see what your approach is, how far this will get you down the road towards the goal of ending homelessness, if it accomplishes it, so I can make the argument publicly in support of your effort.
Sure. Senator Ortman, members of the committee, again, I don't represent the Housing Finance Agency, and the Housing Finance Agency, along with the Department of Human Services and Department of Corrections, are the bodies that are in charge and responsible for implementing the plan to end long-term homelessness, and therefore I cannot speak on their behalf. However, I do know that the plan outlines a specific number of rental assistance units and operating subsidies. It makes assumptions. This year is a time where they have taken stock in that and recalibrated those numbers, and they're in the process of putting that information out to the community. I'm, again, certain I can get that information to the committee members as soon as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Roberts.
And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I think in this packet we have some of that information as well, so I think that your questions are very important, and we need to send those questions to the departments so that they can address them.
Okay. Any further comments from the committee? Okay. Senator Torres-Ray, we'll lay this over then for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
Okay. Who else is here? Senator Clark here yet? Senator Erickson Ropes.
There's an amendment.
Welcome to the committee. Is this your first time, too?
Yes, sir, and I would imagine that Senator Torres-Ray and I are going to be hosting a two-round party.
Do you have an amendment? Is that what I hear?
Yes, sir. That is the A8 amendment. It should be before you.
We got it here somewhere.
Okay. The A8 amendment is the result of continuing conversations between the stakeholders working on this bill. As it goes from committee to committee, they're trying to finesse language and come to agreement that all parties can move forward.
Well, we've got it here somewhere, so why don't you just go ahead and give the presentation. When we find the amendment, we'll put it on.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, members, I'm here today as a co-author of Senate File 828, filling in for Senator Higgins, who's off in another committee right now presenting her public safety omnibus bill. The bill before you, Senate File 828, requires that all health care facilities in the state of Minnesota to adopt a written safe patient handling policy by July 1st, 2008, to achieve the goal of minimizing manual lifting of patients by nurses and other direct care workers, and by utilizing safe patient handling equipment by January 1st, 2011. And I'll just interject at this point, Mr. Chair and committee members, that there's still ongoing conversation between the stakeholders involved in this bill to determine exactly what all healthcare facilities means. I believe that we're targeting nursing homes and hospitals, but when we say all healthcare facilities, we certainly don't want to suggest that we're talking about psychiatric offices,
Senator,
for example.
Senator, we found the amendment. We're passing it out. Is this this something that everybody's agreed to, as far as you know?
The A8 amendment is agreed to by the stakeholders, yes.
Okay. And Senator Metzen moves the A8 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Okay. Now we have the bill in the form that the author would like it. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
So the bill before you today is the result of many negotiations between the parties affected. And as I said, they continue to work on language to finally tune the language that will identify what healthcare facility means. The bill asks for some initial funding for the program. It calls for general fund appropriation to the Department of Labor and Industry for a new safety grant, a $1 million appropriation in the second year of this biennium, 2009. Recognizing the financial constraints we're under, we want to be realistic while not forgetting the financial restraints some healthcare facilities are also currently facing. Members of the committee, investing in this program will reduce healthcare workers' injuries and will in turn reduce their workers' comp costs. They will keep healthcare workers at the bedside where we need them and help keep patients safe. So I would stop at this point and turn it over to Cindy Barnes, who's a member of the Minnesota Nurses Association. She's here to testify. And then we have some witnesses as well.
Ms. Barnes, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you so much for the opportunity to testify in support of the Safe Patient Handling Bill. After working at 32 hours a week or more for nearly 40 years, I retired at the age of 62. Financially, it would have been better for me to continue to work, as I had been living with chronic back pain since 1968. And it was getting increasingly difficult. My body just could not work. I would be working at this time if I thought I could do that work. I continued all those years because I was a single parent and had to support myself and three sons to help them through school, through college, and continuing. Even though I was able to continue working, my injury, as to all injured workers, is a life-changing event. It's the simple things that were affected by the injury, like being able to cook and serve a meal. I worked most of my career in intensive care, and on a typical day, I would have two patients. Good body mechanics were not remotely possible. You can imagine the awkward postures which one could get in and lifting, moving, turning these patients. And we now know that good body mechanics do not reduce the injuries and the injury rate. I was not surprised to read that the average nurse lifted 1.8 tons in an 8-hour shift. We have done the math. It's true.
I thought you were going to say a lifetime. An eight-hour shift.
And an eight-hour shift. Oh. 1.8 tons. Every day I worked, I knew I was one lift away from the end of my career. In addition to being an intensive care nurse, I was an M&A union steward at United Hospital in St. Paul. As a steward, my primary assignment was to work with nurses who had been injured on and off the job and help them navigate through the workers' comp and disability insurance processes and with issues related to return to work at United Hospital. United Hospital, as part of Allina, made a real effort to get people back to work. Nonetheless, there are dozens of nurses over the years that could never go back. Good nurses that should never have been lost. All of them wanted to return to work and were devastated when they couldn't. At one time and one day, I was working with three nurses who had had anterior fusions. And at the end of the meetings, I noticed a sign on a construction site near the hospital. It said, so many days without an injury, and I think that was over 300 or so. And I remember thinking, how ironic. Those guys out in the girders and cranes are safer than I am at work. In the 2004 Minnesota Workplace Safety Report, Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry listed workers with the most frequent OSHA recordable injuries. Of the 14 occupations listed, nursing assistants are number 2, RNs are number 7, and LPNs are number 12. Essentially, the report says that healthcare workers have higher rates of injury and more severe injury than most other workers in this state. The association understands that employers did not intentionally hurt their employees. They relied on industry practice over the years and began to know that it was not effective in preventing preventing injury. We are not here to place blame, but rather to focus on what we can do in the future to ensure safe working conditions in an industry that faces an acute shortage of workers. M&A has worked extensively with Allina and with the Hospital Association to bring a new program, Safe Patient Handling, to Minnesota. We have seen significant success with employers such as Allina, Mayo, Fairview, Bemidji, and some nursing homes. We commend those who are changing, but we need the rest of the employers to follow their lead. Safe Patient Handling is a program based on the scientific work of Dr. William Maras, M-A-R-R-A-S, and was initially implemented at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Tampa, Florida. When the VA started using the new approach to lift, move, and transport patients, two things happened very quickly. The frequency and severity of worker injury declined, and patient injuries related to falls and other things such as skin tears, dislocated shoulders, fractures, pressure ulcers declined as well. That success has been replicated in numerous facilities throughout this country. We have asked for grant money in this bill to assist some employers with startup costs associated with implementing this change. It is not a common occurrence to have a union ask for financial assistance for employers. But we believe it is in the best interests of patients, employers, and workers, and will expedite the changes we need. Nurses and other healthcare workers are not getting any younger. The average age of a nurse is in the mid-40s. The shortage of nurses and other healthcare workers is a continuing issue that does not get better when the people in short supply are injured. And I want you to remember that when a nurse is injured, it is one more patient and one less nurse. Thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you very much, Ms. Barnes. Who else do we have here?
I'm just here for questions.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Carrie Martrude, and I'm one of the staff specialists with M&A. And I just want to clarify that with the request for funding, we did a lot of research trying to find where we could find money. We're still open to where there might be other possibilities to find that. We did want to try to get some money to try to get this initially started and off to the right path. So that's still something we're willing to talk about. And again, Betty and I are just here for questions. So that's all we have to present.
Okay. For our committee members, if anybody has any questions, go ahead and ask them. But we did hear this bill in Senator Metzen's committee, and it's basically here for funding. So That's the reason it's here. So if anybody has any questions on the bill, go ahead and ask. But
Mr. Chair,
Senator Fischbach.
I was just going to ask Senator Erickson Ropes, what other committees has this been through?
Actually, Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, I don't know. I'm standing in for Senator Higgins, who's carrying the bill today.
Senator Fischbach, I think the only one it was in was Senator Metzen's committee, and then it came here.
Mr. Chair and members, and then we went to local state government because there was a rules section,
but we deleted
that section at the advisement of the Commissioner of Department of Labor and Industry and created a new safety grant rather than the changing the rules to the current OSHA grant.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, and whoever can answer, I don't. It hasn't been to Health Committee at all?
It did not. This is dealing with healthcare workers, but it's a workforce development and workforce issue that when we first had it introduced, it was directly sent to business, industry, and jobs.
Mr. Chair, I understand that, I mean, they're going through, the grants are going through the Commissioner of Labor and Industry, but the grants are for equipment, handling equipment. So, you know, that's healthcare equipment. And so I would wonder if it
needs to somehow be connected there. I'm assuming Senator Berglund didn't ask for it, but we can certainly find out if she would like to see it.
Mr. Chair, if it's coming out of labor and industry, it's in your area, so that they're not asking it from the Department of Health, but I'm wondering if Policy Committee would have any interest in Senator Marty's. I guess I'm just kind of wondering because it is, I mean, pretty, yeah, it may have to do with workers, but it has a lot to do with health care, too, and the industry, you know, if nursing homes are going to have to be, it's going to cost money.
Well, let me make a suggestion. We'll lay it on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and we'll find out from Senator Martin if he's interested, and if he is, in our next meeting, we'll move the policy part over there. How's that sound?
And that sounds wonderful, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, Senator Erickson Ropes, I realize it's not you're not chief author, but and I don't know if you would want to make the call on this, but lines 1-7 and 1-8 name the citations. And Senator Dibble is giggling because I wouldn't let him name the Smoking Act last year. and this, you really don't need to name legislation. And so if you felt comfortable, I would offer that amendment.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, I know you have a reputation for cleaning up the bills and making them all consistent from bill to bill. So I think that Senator Higgins would certainly entertain that suggestion.
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Higgins would probably wonder why I didn't do it. If
Senator Dibble.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have to speak against the motion. I like the names of bills.
Mr. Chair, he almost cried last year when I took his name off his smoking bill. No.
Well, I'll tell you what. With all the respect to everybody here, Senator Higgins isn't here. So I don't think we should actually do this.
I understand that, and that's right. Why I was kind of asking if we can do it at some
especially
other
since
time.
You two disagree. Okay, so, Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Following along Senator Fischbach's comments, I'm not as set in my ways as she is, but I support sending this to the Health Committee for the policy impacts and the financial impacts on the health care facilities. I was a nurse's aide in a nursing home many years ago, and I know it can be very difficult work, and the concept here is a great one. But I'm looking at lines 2.33 and 2.34, which says that would create a mandate that the employees who serve on the committee be compensated for all their hours spent on committee business. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but I think that the healthcare industry and the facilities management should be aware of that and have an opportunity to be heard. And I would hope that Senator Berglund or Senator Marty, whichever might be the chair of that appropriate committee, might hear that and give an opportunity to be heard on that issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, just briefly, Dave Renner with the Minnesota Medical Association.
I just want to make a few comments. Senator Erickson Ropes talked about there are still some issues that are still being trying to work out on the definitions. I just want to point out that, and I apologize for coming late to this. We have not been a part of this. When you look at the language of the bill, it talks about licensed healthcare facilities. Mm-hmm. Our understanding as of last night that the intent is to go beyond licensed healthcare facilities and include physicians' offices and outpatient clinics. I think that while we support the goals of what they're trying to do, we're trying to get at here with protecting workers from injuries from lifting, there are many clinics for which there is not lifting that goes on. A dental clinic, potentially, minute clinics, community clinics that deal with low-income patients. So I just want to make sure the committee is aware of that. There is a commitment from both the Minnesota Nurses Association and the authors to continue to discuss, and we will try to work on that. But I wanted to make sure the committee was aware of those concerns. Okay. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any further questions or discussions? Okay, seeing none, well then we'll lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill and for possible referral to Senator Biden's committee. Okay. Okay. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I like the name, but I think he's. Is Senator Clark? Senator Clark's here. Senator Clark. Senator Fogel, where is he? Terry Charles is there. He's still. Okay. Senator Clark, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for your flexibility. And before you get a chance to say it, I want to tell you this is an esteemed committee, and I just wish I could be a part of it.
We had a seat for you, just so you know.
Well, maybe you'll let me come by and visit occasionally. Some of you got a chance to hear this bill in Senator Metzen's committee. I'm very excited to be in front of you today. With me, I have Tom Rainier from the Northland Foundation. And this is a concept that was talked about somewhat last year. You may be familiar with the Initiative Foundations. There are six of them across greater Minnesota. They were originally funded through the McKnight Foundation and have a strong local partnership. They've been helping do a lot of economic development for a number of years. And we have had a state partnership with them previously. We have provided matching funds for business lending administered by the Initiative Foundations. And right now, this new request is to expand on their business development work. And what we're looking for, ironically, it's not a grant, it's a loan. It's a 10-year loan, and for 10 years, they will pay interest to the state, and after 10 years, going to repay the state the funds loaned to them, and they will guarantee repayment of the loan. What they're basically asking for in return is some flexibility in how they administer their business financing activity. This largely will help with startups. I think we all know how challenging it is for new businesses to begin. They have worked with a number of creative entities that are flourishing around the state. And I know that certainly in my neck of the woods with the Central Minnesota Initiative Foundation, they have made a real significant difference. I think what I'm going to do, just because I know that your time is short, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Rainier.
It's fine with us that you turn it over to Mr. Rainier. Mr. Rainier.
Thank you very much. My name is Tom Rainier. I'm the president of the Northland Foundation in Duluth, Minnesota. And Chair Tomasoni, as you know, this is probably not my first appearance before this committee, but I never stand on tradition, so.
Well, as long as you're not a lobbyist, I think you still can buy.
Okay.
I was going to say, Mr. Chair, he obviously is a good educator and is coming to help our state from an economic standpoint, so I know that you're very glad to have him.
Thank you, Senator Clark. Chair Tomasoni and members of the committee. As Senator Clark has indicated, Senate File 165 appropriates $12 million to be distributed in the form of loans of $2 million to each of the six initiative foundations. We propose to make interest-only payments at 1% for 10 years back to the state and to guarantee a full lump sum repayment at the end of the term. Our intention is to use these funds to make investments in greater Minnesota businesses, leveraging private investment and creating quality jobs. Just as general background, the six initiative funds, as Senator Clark indicated, were created in 1986 in partnership with the McKnight Foundation. We have a community and economic development mission. In 1987, we received, all six of us received a special IRS authorization to make business loans as a charitable activity, and that began our business finance activities. To date, the six initiative funds have distributed over $250 million in loans to businesses and grants to nonprofits in Greater Minnesota. Specifically, the collective impact of our business finance programs is noteworthy. 2,600 loans to rural businesses and entrepreneurs, $150 million in investments, over $800 million in additional investments, mostly private investments, and a minimum of 38,000 jobs created. What we do is primarily known as gap financing, where we essentially fill the gap between what the business needs and what banks and other private sources can provide. We step in when there's a collateral or other credit issue that requires one of the lenders to take somewhat of a higher risk than participating banks, and that's us. As Senator Clark indicated, we have a strong relationship with the state of Minnesota. First in 1987, when the Rural Development Act created a program called the Challenge Grant Program, awarding $1 million to each of the initiative foundations for business lending. Then again in 1993, the Challenge Grant Program was reauthorized with an additional $6 million. We've been good stewards of those public resources and continue to provide annual reports to DEED on our overall business financing activities. The Challenge Grant Program funds have likely revolved at least two, perhaps three times, and virtually all of these funds are still working in businesses in Greater Minnesota. The initial $12 million from the state is part of overall portfolios that total about $50 million collectively in each of the six initiative foundations. The balance of our loan capital has come from a variety of other sources, primarily federal and other foundation funds. This funding is needed at this time for several reasons. We've seen a significant change in gap financing need and activity over the 20 years that we've been in this business. It's a new era in economic development financing. Our average loan size has increased from $75,000 to $200,000, with some of us doing deals over a half a million. It just takes more capital. Businesses have higher costs for equipment and technology. It's difficult for financial institutions to finance things like intellectual property, specialized equipment, and so on. They're just not as solid collateral as land and buildings. Our level of participation in individual projects has increased. There are fewer development lenders out there. For instance, in our area, Minnesota Power used to be a big player in economic development lending. They've essentially gotten out of that business, and we filled that void. Bank mergers mean there are fewer hometown banks, and those that want to do these deals are generally stretched beyond their lending limits. The demand for flexible capital adaptable to new types of businesses increased. I know this committee has heard bills relative to bioscience and so on, software development, renewable energy. None of these businesses are financed the way old manufacturing businesses used to be, and it takes a lot more flexible capital. In summary, we're not asking for a loan, for a grant. We're asking for a loan. You have plenty of worthwhile organizations and agencies asking you for long-awaited assistance. Because we're in a unique position of being able to use this money over 10 years and then pay it back with interest, it would be irresponsible for us to ask for free money, as tempting as it might be. We've got a solid track record. Our performance and longstanding public-private partnership with the state of Minnesota demonstrate that the initiative foundations have the competence to make sound investments yielding high returns. This will improve the health of Greater Minnesota communities, making business investments in the context of our other community and economic development programs. This investment complements other economic development tools that the state has created for communities in Greater Minnesota, such as JobZ, the Minnesota Investment Fund, worker training programs, and so on. There will be a double bottom line. The funds will be repaid to the state with interest, no administrative costs, sound results, and accountability. And the funds will help us meet business needs, thereby increasing the economic vitality of rural communities. This helps entrepreneurs stay in and invest in their own communities. The $12 million that you provide would likely be invested in at maximum of 2 to 3 years, leveraging $50 to $60 million in private investment and creating quality jobs generating significant tax revenue. We're grateful for the overwhelming support we've received from legislators and community leaders from every corner of the state, and we respectfully request your support for this legislation. I have a couple of handouts. I won't go into them. They're self-explanatory. One is a couple of loan stories from each of the six initiative regions, and then a concept paper that goes into this further. Thank you, Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Rainier. And we're actually tempted to give you the money without making you pay it back. It might actually be a bigger return to the state. We're not sure. Senator Dibble, did you have a question? Somebody raise their hand over here. Okay. Any questions of the committee? Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Clark, welcome to the committee. A question for you. It looks like the interest that's paid is at 1%. That's the rate of interest.
Yes.
Over the 10-year period. What do the participants pay in interest to the organizations that distribute the loan funds?
It varies. It varies based on the type of business, the policies of each initiative foundation. I think the Northland Foundation is typical, and we will charge from 5 to 8%. So it's generally below what you can get at a bank, but it gives us enough of a spread that we can absorb losses, which we occasionally have. So it's a very favorable interest rate, and that's, we don't mind borrowing money, but we have to have just enough of a spread so we can cover our losses if we take any. And we're a higher risk lender, so from time to time we do.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, who determines what those interest rates are for the participants in the underlying programs?
We determine those based on the needs of the borrower, the level of risk, and the other participating lenders such as banks. We have partnerships with, in our region, we have partnerships with over 40 community banks. We don't do these in a void. Generally speaking, the material that the borrower presents to the bank is the same material they present to us. We do the same due diligence. Our goal is to make the business successful. And so we will structure our deal in terms of the term and the interest rate to help frame that business's bottom line to be successful. So, as I said, it varies from 5 to 8% in our case, always below what the bank charges, but based on all the variables that go into packaging a deal.
Mr. Chair, I'm concerned about the organization paying 1% and having the underlying participants paying more, subject to your flexibility. And I'm wondering if you have experience in this, can you tell me what the risk is that you're concerned about paying for in terms of the interest part of the participants?
Well, I can give you a historical perspective. Over the 20 years that our organization's been in business, we have a loan loss ratio of about 10%, which is obviously unacceptable to any traditional banking institution. But it's very, very standard for development financers like ours. If we're only losing 1% or 2% of our overall portfolio, we probably shouldn't be in the business because those are all bankable deals. If we're losing 20%, we're losing so much capital we can never stay ahead. So 7 to 12% is a very typical loan loss percentage over time for organizations like ours. Hence the difference in what we want to pay for capital and what we can afford to pay for capital and what we charge our borrowers.
Senator Ortman.
Sharon, in these organizations that distribute these dollars, they're nonprofits, but are there profit-making partners as part of the nonprofit organizations that distribute these dollars?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, I mean, the organizations we're talking about are the six initiative foundations. So they're nonprofits themselves. They have board members just like any other nonprofit. There are a variety of people, business and other kinds of leaders that are on these boards. They're the only entities that would be making these loans. No other entity would. There's no in-between, so it's just them.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the clarification, Senator Clark, but what I'm asking is they're nonprofit organizations that are distributing the funds. Are there investors in the nonprofit organizations, are there no private investors, just the public dollars that are being distributed by these organizations?
Senator Artman, the majority of our support, operating support, and support for our grant programs and other programs that we deliver to the communities, the majority of that comes from private contributions, from major foundations, McKnight, Bush, Bremer, Ford, Kellogg, et cetera. Relatively speaking, a very small percentage of our overall income over the last 20 years has been public dollars. But public dollars have traditionally been the best place to find capital for these kinds of loan funds.
Mr. Chair, Senator Artman, I mean, I think part of the point here, we certainly could have been coming, the proposal last year was actually as a direct appropriation, and there could be. So I think going back to your previous comment, the fact that this is highly unusual that an entity would actually be coming back and giving the money back to the state. And so while the interest rate might be low, the reality is that's more than we actually get back from pretty much anybody else that gets state money. And I think if you look at after what the risks are, that's something that is a pretty major accomplishment. But one of the things, just to underscore something that Mr. Rainier said earlier, is that the startup for these businesses now has gotten to be rather complicated. It's very difficult for a lot of these community banks that want to go ahead and invest in these new economic development, hopefully new economic development machines in their areas. They just can't do it. These funds will allow them across the state to help incubate the kinds of businesses that we really want to see to have a renaissance in greater Minnesota. So I want to assure you that between the guarantee and others, we will get the return back as far as the direct appropriation. But more importantly, we'll actually be able to see the kinds of businesses we all talk about every day here, but we don't really have a great way to impact their development. So I think you'd find it to be a cost-effective mechanism for doing that.
Senator Rutman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Clark, again, I think you missed my point. I appreciate your
comments. It could be, Senator Artman.
I appreciate your comments very much. What I'm trying to understand is if we are going to reduce the interest rate to 1% for the organizations, but they in turn pass along a higher interest rate to the participating entities, they're paying somewhere between 5 and 8% is what the testifier said. I'm trying to find out who exactly are members of these nonprofit organizations, and are there profit-making entities involved in this that might benefit from the change in interest rate from the 5 to 8% to the 1%?
Mr. Chair and Senator Artman, no. I think you actually have two different pieces. One is the reason why there is a higher rate that's going out is to cover the potential losses, so they're just covering costs. There's nobody that's getting any direct benefit in terms of making these loans, for profit or otherwise. So, I mean, maybe we're both missing what you're really trying to get at, but there isn't somebody else in there that's getting these resources.
That's correct. I mean, the unique authorization that we receive from the IRS is to allow charitable organizations like ourselves, foundations like ourselves, 501c3s, to provide business capital to for-profit businesses in rural communities, hiring primarily low-income individuals, and thereby directly benefiting those private for-profit businesses by providing them with this low-cost capital. It's a model that's unique in this country. Foundations generally can't provide benefits directly to the for-profit sector, but the IRS has determined that because we're public charities, we are foundations, and we're engaged in that business, that the benefit to the community and the benefit to the individuals that get hired in these good jobs outweighs the fact that a business person can come to us and get a 5% loan rather than a 10% loan.
Are you going to add light to this? Is that what you want to say? Maybe Senator Olson can straighten this all out. Hey.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know about that. But just to follow up on what Mr. Rainier has been saying, if my understanding of this is correct, I think what I'm hearing you say is that because these are inherently risky loans that banks are not allowed to make under because they may not have a history or whatever the reason may be, but we want to encourage this kind of economic development. We make these loans knowing that maybe a higher percentage of them are likely to fail than normal loans. And so the difference in the money that you're able to borrow, the interest rate that you're borrowing the money at from the state and the interest rate that you'll be charging will be used to cover those loans that will not, where a certain percentage of those businesses will fail and not be able to repay the money. And so that should be able to balance so that you won't end up actually losing money in serving as the person or the company making the loans?
That's very correct. But just one clarification. We have banks in 99% of our deals. Banks, community banks, want to do these things. They want to help local entrepreneurs and businesses expand. But when there isn't enough collateral there, when there's some credit issues, the banks will call us and say, on a $100,000 loan, we can do 50. Can you do the rest? So we're not in competition with banks. We serve each other's purposes. Our purpose is to get these businesses stabilized in a full business cycle so that they become fully bankable and they don't need our money anymore.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I think the other thing just to reinforce is that while these are riskier than what is often done within a traditional loan mechanism, 90% rate is actually a pretty amazing number. So I think that's they've obviously have figured out how to make this work over time, and there's definitely assistance along the way in terms of helping those new owners as well.
Senator Clark, counsel has a suggestion on some language here.
Mr. Chairman and members, on line 1.11 or page 1.11, starting with the commissioner shall establish an investment fund. Currently, we do not let commissioners establish revolving loan funds. So my suggestion would be to strike that sentence. The commissioner shall establish an investment fund from which investments can be made to eligible organizations. Change that to an investment revolving loan fund is established from which the commissioner can make loans to eligible organizations.
Senator Sparks will move that amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Any further discussion? Okay. Seeing none, then Senator Clark will lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, members.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Pogemiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 1788 is the second step in a process to deal with the mutual impacts of the University of Minnesota and the five surrounding neighborhoods on each other. The first legislative step, there's been serious discussions going on since about 2003. When President Brunig's made a commitment to deal with this in a very serious way as a university. And the first legislative step was last year when there was a direction to the university and the city of Minneapolis and the surrounding neighborhoods to study the various issues about the mutual impacts of the neighborhoods on the university and the university on the neighborhoods. Because of the concern about the decline in the neighborhoods around the university. There's a lot of reasons for that. University's building additional housing on campus, et cetera. It used to be viewed as a commuter campus by and large. That has changed dramatically since many of you perhaps were at the University of Minnesota. and the president maybe can get into some of that. But so this is the culmination of work that was done by some consultants that were hired by the neighborhoods and the university and the city. That's what these two documents are, the consultants' work. And the neighborhoods we're talking about are these five neighborhoods around the university. The dark red is the university neighborhood. The others are this Marcy Home neighborhood, Southeast Como, Prospect Park, and Cedar Riverside. They're all the neighborhoods that are adjacent to the campus. And the work of this group came to the conclusion.
Where's the map?
I'm sorry. That's on Appendix 2 of the appendices document. So it's in about, it's page 23. And then page 24 and 25 give you a little more close-up. Some of you may have lived in these neighborhoods when you attended the university. Senator Metzen, did you live on
campus? Yeah, I sure did. Territorial Hall. I wasn't.
Oh, you lived in the university campus then.
I had to live there, yeah.
So,
but we were all angels when we hung out there.
So this work by the neighborhoods, the university, and the consultants, and it's quite extensive. I'm not going to go into all of this, but basically the bottom line is the determination is that the health, safety, and destiny of the Twin City campus is very much intertwined with the adjacent communities. The adjacent communities, there's been an erosion of home ownership, more rental, increase in crime, property crime, person crimes, et cetera. And so you've now got a situation where students and faculty are starting to gauge whether it is either safe or a hospital place for them to be. It's not over the edge yet, but it's getting there. And President Brunig's noticed this. He's been at the university many years, but when he took on the presidency, he raised to a high priority this notion that we have to view this as one whole and make sure we don't end up with an island in an urban area where people really just want to get in and out. They don't want to participate in the neighborhood. And they also would like to have more faculty living close to campus so they could walk or bike to campus. And there's a lot of factors why it's developed this way, but this is really a proactive attempt by the university and the neighborhoods to try to figure out how do we not get into a really, really dire situation. And this will involve upgrade in housing, try to increase the amount of home ownership by faculty in the neighborhoods, and things like that. So what the bill specifically does is it asks for $750,000 one-time money as step two that could be used to do some identifiable, tangible efforts, maybe specific project activities to show what could happen if a endowment or some actual serious money was put in place to protect and help these neighborhoods. And so you may do some things in the housing area with this $750,000 so that, and to be truthful, what will happen is if the demonstrable effects can be shown, I will be back either next year in a bonding year or the year after to ask for serious money in terms of how to make this work for the university. This is here rather than higher ed because it is about the neighborhood relationship, housing, crime, et cetera. And the money is given to the university, but that's only as a fiscal agent. It's not money for the university. It's money basically that the university, the neighborhoods, and the city of Minneapolis can use in conjunction to pull together the other resources, private fundraising and other housing resources, et cetera, to deal with some of these issues. Let me leave it at that. And so it's a modest proposal, but it will lead to step three. Hopefully, it will lead to step three either next year or the year after for a more serious state commitment to help with this private fundraising and Minneapolis and the university to chip in to do this also. Let me turn it over to President Brunig to talk about why this is important to the university. There are many neighborhood representatives here from these neighborhoods who have been working on this since 2003 with the university. It is fairly historic to have the university here making a pitch like this because over the years, the neighborhoods have felt that they were all by themselves against this big institution that was basically trying to not worry about the stuff around it and just educate kids. And I think what Dr. Brunings is going to talk about how the newer thinking on this, particularly in places like University of Pennsylvania, Ohio State, is to really think hard and long about how you need to have your neighborhoods work in conjunction with your educational mission and research mission.
President Brunix, it's really great to be a part of history, so
This is historic for the university and its neighborhoods. I guarantee you that.
Senator Thomasoni, it's great for me to be a part of this history, too. And I want to thank Senator Pogemiller for his leadership and his steadfast support for making these issues a really important priority for the university and for our broader community. Joining me is Jan Morlock, who is one of the leaders of the university in connecting the university's resources to our surrounding communities and actually was the one of the leaders that helped frame and support this study. I know your time is really short, so I'm going to just make a couple of really brief comments because you may have questions that you want to address. We're one of a few universities in the country located in a rich and vibrant metropolitan area. And we're one of the few research universities and land-grant universities that you will find in the metropolitan area. We happen to be located in Minneapolis and St. Paul, surrounded by neighborhoods with a very rich cultural history, a strong connection with the University of Minnesota. But as Senator Pogemiller has indicated, the University of Minnesota and many other universities, about a half a dozen around the country, have experienced this kind of neighborhood decline right in their own neighborhood, right in their own community. And we think this is a problem not just for the long-term future of the University of Minnesota, but we think it's a problem for the long-term future of the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area. This will be an area not only where the University of Minnesota will continue to thrive, and every day about 80,000 people on average will come to the University of Minnesota. About 65,000 of them will be students, faculty, and staff. But it's also going to be increasingly an area that will actually provide a great deal of energy to the development of business and industry and culture in the entire state of Minnesota. We view that this will be one of the major incubation sites for the biosciences industry, the technological industries of the future. There are some people in this room who represent those industries. And I will say to you, I will submit that without a vibrant sort of community surrounding the university, one that is hospitable to the talented people that we attract and we need to retain for our very survival, it will become increasingly difficult for the university to live up to its aspirations and responsibilities to the state of Minnesota. So I think the stakes are really high. And the good news here is that this is a community that cares very much about its future, that is a university community, and the surrounding communities have come together to address the issues of children and youth, community vitality, economic development, the quality of housing, safety in the neighborhoods. All of these issues are a part of this report, and they're also part of the thinking of people who really want to move the dial in a much more positive direction. And as Senator Pogemiller said, and you will find examples or citations in the reports, there are many good case studies around the country. I can recall visiting New Haven, Connecticut in the mid-1980s, and it was absolutely destitute around the Yale University campus. It is now a destination place in New Haven, Connecticut. It's a place of thriving businesses, commerce, culture. The university is again, and not only an education and research center of the community, but it's also an increasingly a place to go and a cultural center. The same thing is happening in Columbus, Ohio, with Ohio State University. I spent a lot of time in the 1980s working for the federal government or working with the federal government. In Philadelphia, that whole neighborhood has been transformed around the University of Pennsylvania. There are many other examples that are listed in the report. So we're not really talking about a new experiment. We're talking about best practices, good examples that we can really build on. And I'll make one final point. I think the modest appropriation that is being requested in this bill will be leveraged many times over as we really try to work together, city, state, University of Minnesota, county, and the other entities that need to work together to revitalize these communities and make them a hub of economic and cultural life for the greater metropolitan area. So why don't I stop here and take your any comments and questions you may have at this time.
Mr. Chairman, just I'm going to make two quick there's also a tax provision in here. That's Section 1. That's not something you would need to deal with. But secondly, just to put, just as an example, when the university is recruiting faculty or graduate students, they are in competition with other universities around the country and around the world. And it's not always simply a decision of who pays the most. It sometimes has a lot to do with what's the schools like, what's the living situation for the faculty member. And this is a competitive issue when you think of faculty and students. This is a competitive issue. And for this to be a great university and to reach the aspirations of number three in public universities and research, we have to have a viable neighborhoods around the university. Otherwise, they just will not be able to succeed.
Senator Pogba, is the light rail line going right through here, too?
Yes, it would come through the Central Corridor. It would come through and basically come down roughly University Avenue by the new stadium, by Williams Arena, and then between Kauffman and Northrop on Washington Avenue,
so
roughly.
I assume that's going to be taken into all the...
it would come through this Prospect Park neighborhood and then up through the Marcy Homes neighborhood.
Okay.
Or it might cross the river before Marcy Homes, but Prospect Park neighborhood for sure.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if this is directed either towards Senator Pogemiller or President Brunix. I understand the problem. So this is a question more out of curiosity because I'm not intending to make any changes to the bill. Is this something that spills over into the adjacent St. Paul neighborhoods, or do the businesses on the western end of Midway prevent that? You've got some homes, but it's not like the Minneapolis neighborhoods.
Well, Chair Tomasoni, Senator Cohen, I think it would have relevance for the St. Paul neighborhoods because we have a campus in St. Paul, but the sense of urgency isn't nearly as high in the St. Paul-related neighborhoods as is the case around the Minneapolis Twin Cities campus.
No, Mr. Chairman, President Brooks, I'm not talking about the St. Paul campus, but in the limited St. Paul residential areas that are adjacent to these neighborhoods, if that spills over into that part of St. Paul as well.
That's mostly industrial.
That's what I said. It's mostly business, so I just wondered if...
There is some new housing, which is actually helping the neighborhood. Here in St. Paul, a lot of new condominiums right in here. So St. Paul's actually done some good work right here to help uplift the neighborhood. There's brand new townhouses and condominiums in here.
And there will be some new... and there will be some new student housing in that site as well, or located close to Hubbard Broadcasting.
Yeah, for those who aren't familiar, this would roughly be Highway 280, the border between Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at item number six, the student neighborhood relations piece in the report, and I don't know if you know Senator Pogemiller or President Brunix, but I have a great way you can spend your money if you get all this money. Are you familiar with Chief of Police Hessness has been working closely with Restorative Justice Community Action? Did you mention that before? I was zoned out for just a second. Yeah. it's excellent work that's going on. Works hard to establish. Unfortunately, it's responding to problems. But if problems crop up with student behavior in the neighborhoods, there's the opportunity to bring those students in touch with the neighbors and have a conversation about how what seems to be innocent, fun, college age type of activity.
When you win
really
a championship, you tear down Dickey Town?
Well, there's that. big fun.
Usually when you lose,
the usual kind of activity that go on in the houses around the neighborhood. And it's just been amazing to see how it's not a punitive approach. It's a real positive approach of connecting students to the neighborhoods, getting them involved positively, integrating them into the community, getting the neighbors in touch with the students, starting to view them as citizens and participants and members, full-fledged members of the neighborhood as well. I think it's outstanding. Greg Hessness has been an amazing champion. It's been great. So, if some money does come, I think Restorative Justice Community Action is a
Some of the neighborhoods are using NRP money to do that already, and the university is actually investing in that with the Minneapolis Police Department and other things. The university is already making a fairly significant investment on these types of things, and they're just trying to upgrade this activity so they can really hit a critical mass. Because, their basic mission is to try to keep tuition down and keep the place running.
Right.
But they're trying to nickel and dime to do some stuff, but that's why we're here. We're saying there are limits to what they can pull out of their budgets right now.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Pogemiller. And maybe this also goes along with limited budgets, but I know that Bemidji State University, I think, is the first school within the Minsky system to require community involvement as part of the graduation requirement for students. And I don't know whether the university is already doing that or whether it would be possible to incorporate that into the curriculum in a way to partially address, along with funding, also yes. Address this issue.
Senator Thomasoni, Senator Olson, it is a very strong emphasis and priority at the University of Minnesota. Given the large number of majors, we haven't made it a universal requirement. But I can tell you a very, very high percentage of our students do very active service learning. In fact, they develop sort of organizations and sometimes even 501c3s to carry out their volunteer activities in the community. I was just visiting one of the Minneapolis sites today, in fact. So that's a very, very high priority of the administration, the faculty, and the students of the university. I should say one other thing. As a part of the university's engagement in the community, I have encouraged all of our students to become active in neighborhood organizations. It's part of this continuum of restorative justice that Senator Dibble talked about. But we actually have students sit as ex officio members of many of the neighborhood organizations. Part of this grew out of the unfortunate circumstance following the NCAA victory a few years ago, when I sat down with students and said, "Look, you got to clean up your act. We can't have this kind of disturbance in our own backyard, in our own neighborhood. You have a responsibility to be responsible members of our own community." We later found out that most of the trouble came from the outside and not from students of the University of Minnesota. That's a much longer story, one that was lost, unfortunately, in the media. But this is a big issue. I think universities can't be an island in communities. They have to be strongly engaged, and they have to give something back to their communities. But increasingly, research universities are a place where people come that have enormous talents from all over the world to do research, to interact with the intellectual resources of a great university. They spin off companies. They create cultural extensions that are, I think, really important in our community. And as Richard Florida, a noted economist who studies creative, innovation-based economies, has said, you know, without a vibrant university and without vibrant communities surrounding research universities, the new age economy, the economy that depends on ideas for its very survival, does not do very well anywhere in the world. And we happen to have, I think, a great research university here, great communities that surround it. And if we want to keep growing Minnesota's economy and quality of life, not just in the Twin Cities, but statewide, we've got to make sure that we invest something back in our communities. And so that comes from the students, it comes from the curriculum, it comes from the values of the university, and I think it also comes from the support of our state and our local communities.
Mr. President, I know you're really busy. We appreciate the time. I just want to make two last points. Where the cedar is on this map is where Augsburg College is. And they are very interested. The reason I thought of this is because they do have a mandate for community service as part of their graduation. But they're very interested and have been participating in discussions with the university and the neighborhoods. They have the same concern for their institution in terms of the surrounding neighborhood for them. And then the immigrant population of Somalis is centralized right here in Minnesota. And it's Somalis now. In a previous generation, it was Scandinavians, and this area of Minneapolis has historically been one of the first entry points for immigrants in Minnesota, and it will continue to be, presumably, because it is next to a university. So the vibrancy here and the importance of this location for our state socially and economically just cannot be overemphasized, I don't think. This is not a Minneapolis issue. This is really about Minnesota's face to the world, because all these people from all over the world come to the university, professors and folks, and this is what they see. And now with the Carlson School there, with its second campus, incredible numbers of business people are coming to this location. And we need to have something where people kind of go, oh, that's what they got going there. It's pretty good stuff.
Senator Dibble.
Well, then you just hop over a little further and you get to North Central Bible College and those crazy kids, I'm telling you.
They're hard to handle.
They're thinking about having dances there. No.
Senator Pogamo, did you want to move Section 1 to taxes?
I don't know what your process is. Yeah, probably we should send that down. I was hoping to keep the whole thing intact, but I don't know.
Whatever is your pleasure.
Do you like to have language in your bills if you put money in, or can you just have a line item? Or?
Well, we could just send Section 1, and we could keep the rest of it here.
If that's what makes sense.
Let's put that in a tax bill, right? All right, then. Senator Sparks moves that Section 1 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion adopted. And then we'll just lay over the rest of the bill for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And this is one-time money, right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much for your time, members. Appreciate it.
Senator Kubla, you have to get somewhere. Is that what's going on here? Okay, let's take your bill next then. Welcome, Senator Kubley. Welcome. He's already here. Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 1529 is a request for some assistance for the Upper Sioux community. They need some improvements on their water system that serves the community. There are a number of points that need to be made, but with me today is the chair of the community, Kevin Jensfold. I've known Kevin most of his life. Most of mine, I guess, but anyway, I appreciate his willingness to come and give you some testimony on this problem faced by his community, Mr. Chair, and I think I'll let him give you the bulk of the information.
Welcome, Mr. Jensfold.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Kubley, Senator Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Jensfold. I'm the tribal chairman for the Upper Sioux Indian community, located approximately 4 miles south of Granite Falls, Minnesota, on the Minnesota River. As a member of the tribal council, I am responsible for 450 tribal members. I want to state that I'll be as brief as possible. Being an elected official, I do understand the tedious nature of this type of work at times, so I'll do my best to be as clear and distinct as possible as to this request. A brief background in regards to our water system. Prior to the floods of 1997-2001, the majority of our tribal lands and 50 homes at that time were serviced by private wells. However, after 1997, many of those wells were impacted by the floods, and it was in the best interest of the tribe and its resident population that we have a more stable, clean water source. At that time, our water system was developed, and this request will reflect the deficiencies that we've encountered since then. The scope of our projected and proposed improvements will address both of these issues. The number one issue is that our water system is a linear design, which means that if there is a failure at any point in that system, that anything west of there is without water. The other issue with our water system, as it was designed, understanding we have 1,400 acres of land that is under tribal control, and we are limited in our areas to find a suitable water source. We identified that water source at the extreme eastern edge of our tribal lands, and at that time, it was determined that that aquifer that we are presently utilizing is very limited. it was deemed that it was sufficient to provide enough water usage for our tribal homes, our tribal enterprises, our government buildings, and those things. But over the course of time, and there again I'll reference the floods, again, majority of our lands were low-lying, and at that time it was determined by the tribe that we would try to acquire lands up on the bluff, understanding that we are in the floodplain, the majority of our lands at that time. We now have acquired lands on a higher ground, and we are in the process of trying to develop those for housing and future economic development businesses. And our request is such that we want to try to acquire a stable water supply. We've identified aquifers that are further west of our tribal lands. We've also identified Lincoln Rural Pipestone as a possible supplier of clean water. But in order to access either one of those sources, we have to complete our project, which would include additional water storage and additional lines. And that is the basis of our request for this committee's consideration. I do thank you for your time, and I would welcome any questions you may have.
Mr. Jenswald, I apologize if you said this already, but do you have the $1 million already committed that it says for the private sources?
Yes, we do.
Okay. And have you already applied to the Public Facilities Authority?
It is my understanding through the Senate Council that is an unconstitutional and not a viable option.
Really?
Since we are our unique status as a sovereign government, that that won't apply to us. That's why we are here at this committee.
Harry, do you know that? Do you know this?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Terry Kuhlman, Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority. In the sense that you cannot use state GO bond proceeds because it's Constitution limits those to political subdivisions of the state, and for public purposes, the tribe wouldn't be eligible. When it comes to the SRF program or state revolving fund program, I know EPA takes money right off the top to deal with Indian tribes in both drinking water and wastewater. But it's like 0.5% nationally, and a pretty long list of tribes that need water. It's probably one of the worst drinking water situations in the country is what's on tribal lands. So there's a long waiting list.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Coleman. All right. Thank you very much. We'll lay this over then for possible inclusion.
Appreciate your time, Mr. Thomasonier, and members of the committee. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Kubley. Senator Sharon. What? Yes. Okay. You have two bills, so you can pick which either one you want.
Two both at the same time? One right after the other?
Yeah, whatever you want to do. If you want to start with 1205, go ahead, or if you want to start with 1020, you just decide.
Start with 1205.
Okay.
Here, that I'd like to give you two. Would that be possible? Yeah.
Is that the one?
That's not for this bill. This is for 1205.
Is this her first time?
Mm-hmm. We get three guys.
Thank you, Chairman Thomasoni, and members of the committee.
Senator Sharon, I have to point out that since you're a freshman, this is your first time in front of the committee, that we all expect a round when next time we see you.
Expect a what? A round. I'm glad that this is the issue that brings me to your committee for the first time. I'll tell you that. I expect to be seeing you all again.
Senator Sharon, go ahead.
Okay, I'll begin with Senate File 1205, 1205. This is an exciting project that I'm bringing forward to you for your consideration. It's called the Renewable Energy and Economic Development Consortium Appropriation. It asks for $15 million, $7.5 million in the first year of the biennium and $7.5 million in the second year of the biennium. It will be utilized for two segments. And the handout that you've just received on the first page describes fairly clearly to you how the money will be used and distributed. And the second page, I just want to draw your attention that it describes the consortium, who makes up the consortium, the membership of the consortium, and you can see that it's representatives of both the industry, jobs industry, as well as the Department of Agriculture, Department of Commerce, and also members of university systems throughout rural Minnesota. And also, it describes criteria for the loan for economic development, the ways in which we would determine eligibility and who is eligible, and the criteria for selection, and goes on to say how the applicant needs to present its business plan and how it relates to renewable energy and to the development and the practice of green practices in business. But with that, I just wanted you to have that handout so that you'd understand that this is quite a well-developed proposal, which asks for $15 million. And in that $15 million, what we intend to do is to keep in the rural area some of the secondary economic development that will occur with the renewable energy and the growth of renewable energy industry. It's talking not only about renewable energy fuels being developed, but about businesses, real enterprises that will be developed in connection to the renewable energy industry. For example, right now, and an important part of this is the linkage that's made between the universities and the Minsky system and the applied research that they're doing in renewable energy and how to utilize renewable energy and industry in the development of commerce. So, for example, at Mankato, Minnesota State University is developing a product that can be utilized on standard engines in order for us to use our cars and be able to not only use E10 but E20 fuels. But that's a development of a kit. Now, that kit has to be made, has to be packaged, and has to be sold. And it is those kinds of industries that we're talking about that are secondary to the renewable energy industry that we want to be able to provide loans to. So a good portion of this money is designated to the Department of Economic Development to be distributed for no-interest loans, matching loans, for companies that want to locate and build jobs in the rural area around the renewable energy enterprises. The second portion gives money directly to the consortium that's described in your paper, and that's used to help draw the university systems that are listed here into developing supportive services for industry, using their applied research with industry, and most importantly, in the first year, developing an emissions lab, which is needed in the state of Minnesota in order for us to move forward in terms of what we can do with renewable energy sources for our cars. What are the emissions for these fuels? That doesn't exist now. We have to send off for testing out of state, and we need to develop that in the state of Minnesota. So that's some of the essentials. I'm going to turn it over now to Jonathan Zert, with your permission, who is from the Economic Development Greater Mankato Economic Development Authority, to talk about this further with you, and then we'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Zert, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Zert, and I'm the Executive Director for the Greater Mankato Economic Development Corporation. And our interest in this particular piece of legislation is the excitement and really the energy and the resources it directs directly at business startup and business activity. This proposal is about putting resources available to actually commercialize businesses. It's about taking the science, the applied science, and turning it into product and creating companies and creating jobs. Now, that's different than traditional research. This is about applied science and actually commercializing it. So that's what's very exciting about it. The center itself creates an opportunity where, whether it be farmers, whether that be corn or folks that are growing timber, whether it be businesses that are already in sectors related to creating kits or electronic devices that might be used in this. Whether it be scientists, investors, or public policy arenas, all of these folks have an opportunity to help commercialize Minnesota's energy and bioscience resources into commercial activities. There probably are entrepreneurial activities we can't yet even envision. And that's where some of these activities, this research-based activity that occurs, can be really exciting because it opens up new arenas for us. This is an opportunity for us to generate some thriving, some growing new businesses in rural Minnesota throughout the entire state that leverages on these things like wind and biomass, et cetera, that can help create new business activities. Now, how do we know if this is the right thing? Becomes part of the question. Does this take us to the right place? We know that lots of folks are talking about bioenergy and biobusinesses. We are at a point where we are beginning to become very aware of our opportunities that sit around us related to the bioactivities. And we sit right in the middle of that. When you look at the resources that exist in our state, across our entire state, we sit at some of the richest part of the globe that has the ability to generate these kinds of energy and bioactivities. But recently, if you're familiar with the Kauffman Foundation, and some of you have heard me mention this before, but the Kauffman Foundation is one of the country's premier entrepreneurial or emerging enterprise organizations. They study this kind of activity. They look at where we ought to go in order to help cultivate and catapult these types of things forward. They released two different reports within the last couple of weeks. I just want to just highlight a couple of items that come out of that. One is they talk about public policy that needs to be done in order to bring about the new economy, as they call it. And the new economy is something that hinges on knowledge-based activity, technology-based activity, globalization, etc. One of the key four elements that they talk about is promoting innovation. And this is what they say about it. Innovative entrepreneurship cannot occur unless the innovation pipeline is full and incentives for commercializing innovations are in place. Incentives for commercializing innovation. When you look at this $15 million, $10 million of it are in the largest increments, $500,000 zero-based interest loans. That means the smallest of companies are going to come forward. The company that's going to make that kit is likely going to be a startup company, not some large existing company today, but somebody that's going to move forward to move that forward. They're going to need $1 million or $1.5 million or $2 to get that company up and running. This $500,000 helps leverage that and give them the equity or the incentives that they need to do. In addition to that, these dollars can be used for equipment that can be shared between the institutions and the industry, faculty expertise, etc. So those tools become incentives. Let me give you one other example from the second report that this group published. It was what they called their New Economy Index. And they said there are 9 key strategies that states can employ to bring about this new economy and stimulate entrepreneurship. Of those 9 key points, there's 4 of them that I'd highlight for you. The first one, align incentives behind innovation economy fundamentals. That's the matching loan. Second, co-invest in innovation infrastructure. Well, that's the expertise, the talent, the faculty, and the equipment. The third, co-invest in the skills of the workforce. Part of these funds, part of that $5 million, are funds that can be leveraged for workforce training. And the fourth piece I'd pull out of those 9 is support industry clusters. And whenever we talk about creating clusters, we're talking about bringing activities together around knowledge, talent, and production type of activity. This is about biorenewable energies. So it's those types of things that I would say give us the reason why is this important and why now does it make sense. The other thing that I'd set on top of this center of renewable energies hubbed at Minnesota State Mankato is that's already also the home for the Center of Engineering and Manufacturing Excellence. You're going to need that kind of talent, skill, understanding, etc. to be there and transcend across those centers and coexist to help really leverage that kind of expertise and talent and be a place that's of attraction. That Center of Excellence is already a consortium across the entire state that has 7 formal partners and all the rest of the Minsky system at the table involved in the Center of Excellence. If Dean Fry, who's the dean for the College of Science and Engineering and Technology at Minnesota State, were here, he would also tell you that within the Minnesota Center of Renewable Energies, formal partnerships, are already being developed with other MinSCU partner institutions outside of MinSEMI or the Center of Excellence. In addition, conversations are also underway with the University of Minnesota to say, how can we continue to share that expertise and knowledge, take base research, take it to applied science, create and stimulate economic activity? With that, I'd close my prepared remarks, and we'd open for questions or thoughts.
Very good. Well, with this whole renewable standards bill that we passed and the governor signed a while back, that makes this even more exciting and timely. And
precisely.
Some people estimate it's going to be a $20, $30 billion business going forward. And as long as we're the leaders, at least with initiatives that we have to fulfill, we have to be doing these kind of things, I think. We got to be out front.
Yep.
Be the leaders and take.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would assume that you're very aware of Congressman Peterson's interest in this area as well, and Congressman Oberstar, too, with respect to transportation, that there's coordination going on with the federal government. And I know that Senator Sharon is aware that I've asked for their participation in a summit at Bemidji State University this summer. We're working on getting a date nailed down, but I'd just like to invite you to take part in that summit.
Thank
because
you.
It sounds to me like you'd have a lot of valuable information to share.
Thank you. I'd be happy to.
Senator Dibble, did you have a question?
Thanks. No, just a comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Senator Sharon, you and I should get together and talk because I have a bill that speaks to a slice of what you're talking about. It's the workforce development piece. I've got a bill that specifically calls out and asks for some thinking and some work to be done this year yet that would make recommendations to the legislature as well as our institutions of higher education around what we're going to need in the renewable energy economy in the way of specifically what kind of trades, what kind of skill sets we're going to need to implement the renewable energy technologies, but also, you know, going beyond that, what do we need in those institutions in the way of thinking, development, research, and that sort of thing. But it's got a real focus on the kind of workforce we need in the future. It's a bill that's in this committee, so we could probably marry up these ideas a little bit.
Mr. Chair.
Senator, sure.
I'm really excited about this bill because it takes it to the next level where we start to have a benefit in terms of jobs, real in the rural economy. We just lost 140 jobs, Mankato, high-paying jobs, because a company that grew up in rural Minnesota was bought out by a larger company, and now they're reorganizing, so we're losing those jobs. And it's this kind of investment in rural Minnesota that allows us to have another cottage industry, another entrepreneurial effort occur and reestablish that job base in the rural areas. So this is critically important. And so many of the products that are a part of the renewable energy effort are already coming from the rural part of the state, so we want to continue to benefit, to meld the applied research that's done in the system, the engineering and technology, the product, and enterprise together. And then if you'll just indulge me further, I want to draw your attention that Senator Julie Rosen is here. I don't know if you're here for another bill, too, but Senator Rosen is a co-author with me, as is Senator Tomasoni, on this bill. And I don't know if she would like to address you in any way.
No, we don't need her.
We're all right.
You're good. You're doing good.
You're doing very well.
You're doing good.
When you think you've got the order, you...
Okay. Very good. So
I think she brought the round, though, Mr. Chair.
Yes, she did. Vandiver. Any comments or questions from the committee? You know, the only thing we got going here that's might be a potential problem is that we've got about four or five great big bioscience bills, and so we're going to have to actually try and figure out $32 million total, how they interact and where we can put the money in. Because I think that I like the way you think.
I would just speak, Mr. Chair, if I may, that the unique character of this is the enterprise, the fact that we're trying to take the next step and make sure that we position Minnesota to be taking advantage of the enterprise that occurs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree. Okay. No further questions, then we'll lay this one over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And then, Senator Sharon, you have Senator 1020.
1020. As you are so indulgent of us, I will give you the relief of making much of an open statement. I simply will introduce you to Mr. Leonard, who is going to speak to the issue that is in this Senate file 1020, an appropriation for the Nicollet County Historical Society.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Ben Leonard, Executive Director of the Nicollet County Historical Society, headquartered in St. Peter, Minnesota. I'm used to being Jonathan Ziert's foil, so I'm happy to be not as eloquent and not as dynamic as him, but hopefully I can be brief. I apologize as well for the state fair approach to handouts, but my goal is to give you as much information as you need without having to talk for hours and hours. So
we're all speed readers, you know.
We're all speed readers?
Yeah, we're all speed readers.
Excellent. We'll only refer to a couple of the handouts, and I'm not offended by recycling, so do as you please. I have a prepared statement that I'm more than happy to answer questions. The Traverse des Sioux has been a gateway and a gathering place for thousands of years. At this place, named Ojuwege by the Dakota, there was a shallow rocky place in the state's longest endemic river that allowed people to cross. This river crossing at the Traverse des Sioux also marked the intersection of the Big Woods and Tall Grass Prairie, two of the state's three major environments. This made Traverse des Sioux a natural place, literally, for people to come together, and they did. Archaeologists working with the Minnesota Historical Society in 1998 unearthed two projectile points dating back 9 to 10,000 years, as old as the river valley itself. Later, the Dakota and then the Europeans traveled and lived there. All of this made Traverse des Sioux a logical place to sign a treaty in 1851, which became known as the Traverse des Sioux Treaty. Treaties between the U.S. government and Minnesota tribes began in 1805 and ended in 1858. But the Treaty of Traverse des Sioux was arguably the most important. It covered a huge area, 24 million acres, encompassing an area from present-day Winona to Moorhead to Laverne. It covered parts of what are now the districts of Senators Sparks, Koch, Dibble, Fischbach, Kubley, Metzen, Ortman, and Parisot. It represented almost 40% of what would become the state of Minnesota. The treaty had an incalculable effect on the Dakota Nation, on what we think of the state today, and Minnesota's place in America. The Treaty Site History Center, headquarters of the Nicollet County Historical Society, was built in 2004 adjacent to the Minnesota Historical Society's Traverse des Sioux State Historic Site. I'll just direct you to the quick backgrounder there. We serve about 50,000 people a year. We operate five sites, the Treaty Site History Center, East St. Julian Cox House, and then along with three state historic sites that we have contracts to manage, Traverse des Sioux, which is adjacent to the Treaty Site History Center, the Harkin Store, located by New Ulm, and Fort Ridgely, just south of Fairfax. You see our total operating budget, expected income for 07, expected expense. And then I will refer you to the project summary as well, which is on the other side. We are requesting $150,000 to fund a 2,000-square-foot exhibit, permanent exhibit, in our central gallery to create a sense of place for the visitor, interpret the treaty, and discuss the effects the treaty had and continues to have on the land and peoples of Minnesota and Nicollet County. A brief proposed budget is there. I want to stress that this exhibit will be all things modern exhibits are: dynamic, factual, visually stimulating, inclusive, and interactive. This is a universal story. All residents and visitors need to be able to relate to it, whether they are an 80-year-old white retired farmer, a Dakota third grader from Lower Sioux, or a recent Somali immigrant to St. Peter. And I'll close with five reasons I'd like the committee to consider this appropriation. One, I firmly believe the Treaty of Traverse des Sioux was and continues to be incredibly important for all Minnesotans, especially residents and visitors to Nicollet County and the entire Minnesota River Valley. Two, the Treaty Site History Center is best equipped to tell this story. We, along with the adjacent MHS Interpretive Trail, are at the site where history happened. We are located directly on the U.S. Highway 169 corridor, just south of the Twin Cities metro area, and see 23,000 vehicles pass every day. We also operate Fort Ridgely and Harkin Store state historic sites that tie into the same historic themes. And we have a close relationship with the Minnesota Historical Society. Three, this exhibit would dramatically improve our ability to tell the story and to tell it in an effective and dynamic way to a variety of audiences, many of whom are currently underserved. Four, NCHS is already an economic driver in the region, producing $55,000 in visitor-generated revenue in 2006 and spending nearly $290,000. With this exhibit, we can play a larger role in attracting more people to the region and further diversifying the local economies of St. Peter and Nicollet County. And five, simply without this appropriation, the project will not happen. The organization is committed, professional staff is in place, the public is extremely interested, we simply lack the funds. I really appreciate your time. Please don't hesitate to ask any comments, questions, or concerns. If it's outside this hearing, I'm available. My business cards were included. And I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you. That's all really interesting. Any questions of the committee? Thomas? Senator Sharon, any final comments? Okay. Then we'll lay this one over also for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Do you have any further comments that you'd like?
Thank you.
This is all really interesting stuff. It's
thank you, Chair.
The size of the treaty is amazing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Sharon.
Yes, thank you.
You want to go next? Or you want to let Rose go? Thank you. Senator Metzen. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Hopefully this will be quick, I hope. I found 995 hired industry sector training. This program is designed to help low-income workers improve employability, income opportunities, and advancement. A client served last year was 8,800 of these. Actually, they range in all ages. 43% are African Americans. Asian accounts for about 6%. Caucasian about 46%. 22 to 30 years old, about 35%. We can go on and on with statistics, but I don't want to worry with those. But Hired works with employers to develop training, and what they try to do is focus on what's needed out in society at the particular month or year. Right now, they're working primarily with the manufacturing and hospitality industries because that's where the jobs lately are needed. So that's where the major training trying to do in that area. I think I'm going to, with that, the hour's late. I'll let Jane Samardzija kind of give you a brief further explanation. This is a wonderful program. Really helps a lot of kids. All ages, but it works. It really works, and we think it's a small appropriation. I think we got $200,000, $208,000, and $200,000. And $209,000, this leverages a lot of money and trains a lot of people. Anytime you can train and boost up about 8,800 people, that's pretty good bang for the buck. So, Gene, did you want to?
Thank you, Senator.
Yeah. Okay, Ms. Samardzija, welcome to the committee.
Senator Tomasoni and members of the committee, as Senator Metzen said, I'm Jane Samardzija. I'm executive director of HIRED, a nonprofit agency that for 39 years has prepared low-income and disadvantaged people, as well as dislocated workers, to qualify and obtain jobs. Senator Metzen mentioned that we serve around 8,000 people a year, a very diverse group in the greater metropolitan area. And we do this by working in partnership with employers, training institutions, and a network of community-based organizations. I'm here this afternoon to ask for your support for Senate File 995, which would provide an appropriation for industry sector initiatives specifically developed and coordinated by HIRED. Just to give you a couple of quick definitions on what this means, sector workforce development strategies seek to directly improve the matching of low-income or other targeted job seekers to employment opportunities in local and regional economies. Sectoral workforce development strategies also restructure training, recruitment, and hiring patterns in selected
industries. So in addition to preparing low-income workers to go to work and meeting the needs of employers, we're also affecting some system changes here in the way that workforce development systems and educational systems have been working. Very briefly, to give you a little history on this, HIRED is currently managing two sectoral initiatives. They are, as Senator Metzen said, presently in the manufacturing and hospitality sectors. The manufacturing program was launched in January 2005 after more than a year of planning and fundraising by an active advisory group, including industry leaders, workforce agencies, policy advocates, HIRED and Hennepin Technical College, which actually is related to the involved in the centers of excellence that the previous testimony, previous two testimonies mentioned. This effort was supported by the Precision Metal Forming Association of Minnesota, and the partnership was chosen as a demonstration site for the National Association of Manufacturers National Manufacturing Careers Campaign. This project was so successful, actually, that our team was asked to go to Cleveland, a good old manufacturing town in the Rust Belt where I'm from originally, to train them in how to also implement a sector initiative and a partnership like this one, and to carry forward this kind of good work. Over the two-year period of the grant that actually ends this month, we were able to recruit and train 100 low-income individuals and place 75 of them into manufacturing jobs in our partner companies. And I think it's important to note that we started out in this partnership with 8 manufacturing firms spread in the outer suburbs, and today we have 40 participating employers. This really caught on with small manufacturing companies, family-owned businesses, and we're still adding employers today. All of the trainees have been low income, and 81% of the trainees in this program came from minority groups, and a fairly significant percentage were also recent immigrants to Minnesota. This program was also made portable, and it was taken into Minnesota correctional facilities, both in Shakopee, in order to give non-traditional training to the women who are inmates there, and also it is now being offered at the Minnesota Correctional Facility in Stillwater. We've calculated the return on investment for this segment of our sector initiative, the return on investment to the community for this project, at approximately $38 on every dollar invested for your average low-income participant in the program. And for those participants in the program that were in the correctional facilities, the return on every dollar invested to the community is $78. I have a handout here for you that shows you our ROI calculations, as well as some other information. I'm sure you'd be interested in looking at that. Based on this extremely professional program, we've expanded this initiative recently with a grant from the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development into the Empowered program. You'll see a flyer on that in your handout. That provides basic manufacturing skills training for careers in welding, CNC machining, and metal forming. Partner employers have helped to write the curriculum that is provided by Hennepin Technical College. In addition, over the next 2 years, we'll also train 120 low-income workers with limited skills, many of them limited English speakers, for advancement in the hospitality industry. The curriculum for this is provided by the American Hotel and Lodging Association Educational Institute, and our partners include major hotels. We picked this sector because it shows high growth stretched over a great period of years, and it also has the wonderful advantage of being an occupational sector in which you can start relatively at the bottom and work your way up to much higher positions in a hospitality institution such as a hotel. One of our member hotel companies noted that a great number of their managers and executives actually work their way up the career ladder. So this is a good one for our low-income people. I want to briefly tell you about the need for sustaining industry sector initiatives. That's why I'm here today. I've been in this business many, many years, and throughout all of those years, I have seen and heard at many meetings, at testimony here at the legislature, at the Capitol, that the business community has consistently experienced a disconnect between its needs for trained workers and the ability of the workforce development and the educational systems to efficiently provide them. This longstanding situation is exacerbated now by the demographic trends that combine the impending retirements of large numbers of skilled workers that will have to be replaced by fewer workers who in large part will be unskilled and non-traditional workers. The other side of the coin, the non-traditional workforce has also experienced a disconnect with these same systems. For many low-income workers who are struggling to support families, the ability to invest family resources in an education and to take time away from work to pursue educational goals is an unattainable dream. Most traditional workforce and education systems don't provide market-based education that is short-term and provides a credential upon completion that connects them with these employers who have been asking for workers to be trained specifically for their businesses. Typically, company owners and managers, particularly in small companies where the bulk of job creation occurs, do not know how to access these systems for training specifically to their industries. They don't know where to recruit, appropriately screen trainees, or how to find support for the non-traditional labor force of the kind it often needs to complete training and get through those first few months on the job. Our industry sector initiatives have been successful in eliminating this disconnect. Because of the commitment of all of our stakeholders and their respective roles in this project, but also because HIRED has functioned as the project coordinator, a key role in the success of a multifaceted partnership. Partnerships are very popular because we can leverage funds, bring a lot of different resources to the table, but multifaceted partnerships have to be managed and have to be coordinated, and communication has to be upheld and fed back and forth throughout the partnership for it to succeed. HIRED plays that role, and that's key. HIRED's role is to recruit and carefully screen the training candidates, to report and track data, to monitor outcomes, to coach and support the trainees, to staff the employer advisory committees, and to develop new initiatives in new sectors. As represented by this diagram in your packet that shows our logo there in the center, HIRED is the hub that holds the wheel together and keeps current projects rolling along while new projects are developed to meet the needs of other occupational sectors. Unfortunately, this role does not receive adequate financial support from project funds that are largely dedicated to curriculum development and tuition payments. The appropriation I seek today is to sustain this successful approach that can be replicated anywhere in the state. The appropriation would be used to support the development and coordination of new sector initiatives and the training of low-income people for jobs that meet the critical workforce development needs of area businesses. At a return on investment to the community of $38 to $70 for every dollar invested, the appropriation would quickly be returned to the community. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Senator Metzen,
thank you very much.
Senator Metzen, you mentioned that it was a one-time appropriation, but would you prefer that it were ongoing?
Yeah, I think it's been an ongoing, but I mentioned it 200,000 one year, 200,000 the next, and then
right.
We'll come back again. This is really a successful program. I hope we demonstrated that today. It's changed a lot of lives, whether it be with the youth offenders, whether it be with the Hmong community, whether it be with pregnant women and women with little kids, it works. I mean, it really works, and hopefully we can save a little at the other end with the prisons and what have you, if we can find a place for these people to get training and put them to work. And this is a true success story. I mean, you hear a lot of good things here, and I hear in this room, but this one has got a track record, and it works.
Okay. Any further questions or comments of the committee? Okay. Seeing none, then we'll lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Good job.
You're being very patient, too.
My people are.
They're very patient, too.
Did
she want her own, too? No, Senator
Rosen. Jerry's picking on the other Italian.
Yeah, okay. Senator Rosen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate File 1303 is a nanotechnology development fund for small business companies. And in all seriousness, nanotechnology or nanoscience is the science of the very small. You're supposed to laugh, Senator Tibble. It truly is a very exciting technology, a very exciting part of bioscience. And I hope you all had a chance, members, to go down to the biobusiness expo that they had downstairs in the Great Hall. It was really exciting. They had great attendance, and that was just a sampling of what's available in our state. And it kind of gave you a good idea of what we are making our investment in. But nanotechnology is truly going to be our next industrial revolution. It's not just a concept anymore. The definition of nanoscience, according to the National Science Foundation, refers to the manipulation and control of a matter at the nano level, which is a nanometer is a 1/1000000th of a meter. The National Science Foundation predicts that the global market for nanotechnology will reach $1 trillion in the next 20 years. And the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office just created a whole new registration category for nano inventions. And as my testifiers will say, they'll talk about what is nanoscience. It's not just the biomedical area. But many large companies have been using nanotechnology for years, and they can afford the required expensive instrumentation. It's the small companies that are struggling, and that's where we want to make our investment because they are in their early stages of development, and they must rent the equipment by the hour, which is very, very costly, as you can imagine. So this is a unique proposal because it's the large companies that are making a match investment, a matching dollar investment for these smaller companies because they understand the big picture that we are investing here. So basically, Senate File 1303 creates a fund, the Nanotechnology Development Fund, the NDF, which would be administered by deed to develop a unique collaboration between the state, the private sector, and multiple academic institutions. This fund would be for businesses that are under 50 employees. The fund would provide matching grants if the person receiving the grant can demonstrate a corporate qualifying expenditures to assist with nano instrumentation, basically the equipment, and provide experienced research consultants. That's where there's two separate funds there for those two categories. The fund also would provide the opportunity to influence Minnesota's future workforce through merit-based internship scholarship program that would expand the number of researchers working with nano application to medium-large companies. And this would also be a one-to-one match with the NDF fund. So if I could, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to introduce... Who would like to go first? Okay, Dr. Baker.
Dr. Baker, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Richard Baker. I am Vice President of Engineering for MTS Systems, and I'm here today representing Minnesota Nano, the nonprofit, as their chairman of the Advocacy Committee. Some of the things I've heard today in your testimony have been related to creating industry clusters, a knowledge economy, and investing in workforce development. I think we've captured all of those here with this proposal. Minnesota Nano is actually a private sector-led group that of companies that have gotten together that see the value of having a vibrant nano-related technology ecosystem where we all get together and discuss and share what's going on from a development standpoint. We also see the value of having a vibrant emerging companies in the area. If you can turn to the third page of the handout, if you have that, you can see a list of the companies. There are some, they come from all across the spectrum as far as industry sectors. So we have people from medical devices, from different polymers, Seagate there for disk drive industry. So a number of different ones, as well as the university. And all of us have come together. We're doing a lot of other activities, but this is one thing that we think the state should do. So first of all, what is nanotechnology? We've talked about the definition of it, but fundamentally at small size scales, so getting down to the size of a molecule, different matter behaves differently. You can get different properties that you wouldn't expect, some unexpected results, and we can put that to good use to develop new products. I won't thrill you with all the examples, but you're going to hear some related to the bioscience area. There are other ones that are related to energy and to almost every sector in the economy. As Senator Rosen mentioned, that industrial firms are already using this technology. This is one of the hottest areas of research. The fund here is targeted towards helping small and emerging companies use the same technology to see the same benefits. We think the benefits to Minnesota Nano, Minnesota is job creation and retention, maintaining our quality of life by having us lead in the knowledge economy, and it builds on the strengths in biomedical technology, biotech, agriculture, food science, energy, electronics, and advanced materials. There are components of this proposed legislation for workforce development in the form of interns that could work in nano research with the emerging companies. This also will leverage investments that have been made in characterization and fabrication facilities already at MinSCU and the University of Minnesota. And it will also help adoption of an emerging technology into the economy. So we're supporting companies that already exist. It's not asking people to bet money on things that don't exist yet. And it's a matching fund where the market is already saying there's a need, and that's being filled, and it would just be helping steer more of those types of companies and activity to Minnesota.
Thank you, Doctor. If we were to merge this with something, would it fit best with bioscience commercialization, biobusiness alliance, biobusiness development, or rural renewable energy and economic development consortium? I suppose it would fit in all of them.
Mr. Chair.
Uh-huh.
This has a matching grant to it, and that's the strongest part of this whole component, is that the industry's commitment to this with the appropriation from the state. So I'm not sure if you could. I don't know.
I mean, maybe this.
But as far as the concept.
Yeah, maybe this is for the witnesses. Would this interact? Will you be interacting with these other things that we're trying to do here? I mean, can you foresee that?
Okay. Senator, Mr. Chairman. I think the nanotechnology is broader than bioscience, so it's going to, and then the renewable energy. So it's a more of a foundational or fundamental area of research. So this is going to cut across a lot more industries than either of those two. So it would support things outside of those other areas you mentioned, so it'd be restricting it to combine it.
So we should fund this one and not the other ones, then, if we have it.
Obviously, that's your decision, but...
good answer. Okay, do you have another witness?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do have Ms. Karen Arnold from Nanocopia.
Ms. Arnold.
Senator Thompson, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to come and talk to you today about this very important initiative. I'm Karen Arnold, and I'm the CFO of a small startup company that deals in nanotechnology. Nanocopia is a company that's based on a technology that was developed at the University of Minnesota, the ability to make nanoparticles. What we do as a business is we take the nanoparticles that are made by the process that we have invested in and use them as coatings on medical devices, and we use them as drug formulations for drug materials that are not very soluble. It makes them more soluble and so that they can be better used by the body. We're here as a company because we're a big user of the CareFac facility at the University of Minnesota. That's one of the programs that small companies like mine will have better access to. Because we have received 4 SBIR grants through the federal government, that's enabled us to leverage our research and be able to have access to those facilities. They're very expensive facilities. At $600 an hour, we couldn't afford to have very many hours of imaging time over there if we weren't, in our case, subsidized by some of our federal grants. The work that we're doing at the characterization facility, you see some pictures in your packet there of some of the devices that we're putting coatings on and some of the drug formulations that we're doing. The imaging that we do shows that we actually are able to create those nanoparticles. Now, the way that our business is going to grow and create jobs in Minnesota and become someday the next MTS or the next Medtronic or Boston Scientific, which is where we expect to go as a company, is going to be by proving that we can actually create functional coatings and that we can create functional drug formulations using our process, and that those particles are intact and that they are, in fact, able to do what we say they can do. The work that we've done at the characterization facility in proving that those particles are there is in part how we got those grants that then kind of fuels the engine and keeps us going down that track of grants. And so we think it is really important, especially for little companies, to be able to have access to those pieces of equipment. Another issue with those pieces of equipment, particularly the University of Minnesota, the National Science Foundation has invested in that equipment at the university. It's something called the NNIN. It's a nanotechnology national initiative. And the National Science Foundation requires that the University of Minnesota work with little companies like ours to prove that federal dollars are being invested and spent well. However, the University of Minnesota can't charge preferred rates to little companies. They have to charge the same rates to us that they would charge to MTS or to Medtronic or to Boston Scientific. So this program through the state of Minnesota actually allows a match. So we can pay our share. This fund will help us pay, and it meets the requirements of the federal grant from NSF that the state of Minnesota does. So actually, you get a twofer out of the whole thing. Well, kind of a threefer maybe, because the university benefits, companies like our company, Nanocopia, benefit, and the National Science Foundation gets to help more companies. So we think that this is a really important program to invest in, and it's important. Big companies like Medtronic or Boston Scientific or MTS they buy their own imaging equipment. They do all that work in-house. And so little companies like ours need to have access to shared-use facilities like that. Legislation like this that's being proposed here, it really does make a difference in helping Minnesota companies grow and be more competitive. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay.
Mr. Chair, there's not too many things I get excited about. Except packing houses.
I noticed that today.
and this bill, because I just want to point out again the partnership.
Anything else you get excited about?
Mr. Chair, nanotechnology and I'm stuttering. But it's the partnership between the state and the private sector. I mean, this is truly a unique situation, and the higher ed institutions. It's very exciting. And frankly, with this matching grant, it's exciting. So The one thing I do want to say, too, that I believe Senator Dibble mentioned, and that was our intellectual property, and that's where we are cultivating and hopefully keeping our intellectual property with this bill, with this relationship and this commitment in Minnesota, with not only just the merit-based internship, but the relationships between the small and the large companies. And I think that's really a key part of it also. Otherwise, I would appreciate your support, Mr. Chair, and anything you do for this, that would be great.
Okay. Well, you know, we're aware of the fact that as a state in the last 4 years, we haven't done very much investing in things like this, and so it might be time that we start putting some money into biosciences and nanotechnology and whatever the rest of the stuff is here that's going to be the next leg in our economic development.
Renewable energy.
And renewable energy and whatever else there is. But it's time that we start investing, that's for sure. So thank you very much. Appreciate
thank
it.
You,
we'll
Mr.
lay
Chairman.
This over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Senator Dibble. Thank you for being patient.
I guess that's my price we pay for being on the committee.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you were just unlucky. You were down the list, that's all. Do you have an amendment, Senator DeMille?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have the A1 amendment.
That puts it in the form that you want the bill to be in. So Senator DeMille moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion is adopted. Okay, Senator DeMille.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1030 would seek to establish a coordinating framework for the purpose of working with those organizations who serve Minnesotans with disabilities in employment settings to be able to better bid for the variety of goods and services purchased by the state of Minnesota. As we well know, being in a finance committee, the state of Minnesota purchases quite a bit every year as an enterprise, $2.5 billion, I think, purchasing outside services and products, according to my notes here. What this bill would do would create a planning grant to develop an entity that works with those organizations that provides that works with people with disabilities to manufacture those goods, to provide those services, and the like. We are one of very few states that don't actually do this already, provide the sort of technical expertise and the coordinating framework and the competency to more effectively and efficiently respond when the state of Minnesota puts out a request for proposals or a request for bids. With that, Mr. Chair, we have a couple of folks who actually provide those services, work with those folks in the disabilities community. And I'll just add very quickly, 35% of Minnesotans with disabilities are unemployed, highly dependent on government support programs. And we've seen in a number of the bills I presented, a number of bills that have been in front of this committee, extended employment services and similar sorts of supports that work with these communities and work with those employers. Have a tremendous effect and impact on people's ability to live independently, to earn their own income, to live with dignity, and of course to provide much needed value to our community and to of course the state as a whole.
Senator Dibble, do you have another amendment you want to put on the A1 8070122?
No. I guess not.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, are you referring to the 0122?
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah, no, I guess we're not going to go with that.
Okay, all right. Okay.
So,
do you want to go first?
Do you want me to explain?
Do you want to go first? Okay. Mr. Chair, we have Lynn Osterman here who can explain quickly what this planning grant would propose to do more specifically.
Ms. Osterman, welcome to the
committee. And, Mr. Chair, members, there's a handout with some slides that I believe she'll be referring to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We appreciate the opportunity to be here. We know that the day is wearing on, so we'll be as brief as we can be. This is a concept that one of my clients that I work with, MACRO, which is the Minnesota Association of Community Rehab Organizations, has been looking at now for about 2 years. They've gone to other organizations who also provide services to persons with disabilities to suggest that, as Senator Dibble referred to earlier, that we be more like some of the other states that are overtly providing opportunities to persons with disabilities to gain employment by letting some of the contracts for either services or goods go to those organizations. We are modeling this program after a number of other states' programs, and so we've taken a look at different models, if you will, and we've formed a coalition that also has included at least they're not an official voting member, but the Department of Administration has been meeting with us as we've looked at other states and what other states are doing. You've got a page in your packet that talks about some of the examples of products and services that we would be talking about in terms of what we would propose to have happen here in Minnesota. Within services, for instance, janitorial, document imaging, document destruction, there are numerous things that we can be doing that our clients could be doing for the state of Minnesota. And these are already contracts that are being let in some way, shape, or form. With regard to products, there are examples from other states where literally every pen that a state purchases, and I apologize, I'm not recollecting which one that is. It might be Texas. I don't recall. But literally every pen, be it a blue pen, a red pen, or a black pen, are manufactured now by persons with disabilities, and then the state purchases all of those. And we're not just talking about the state of Minnesota, Mr. Chair and members. We're also talking about all government entities. So we're talking about counties. We're talking about municipalities, towns, cities. We're also talking about school districts or universities, public schools. Skipping ahead, I just wanted to show you kind of how this would work, and then we'll hear from our other testifiers. You have a slide that shows Minnesota Works, if you will. That's what we're calling this entity, at least in our planning mode. It talks about Minnesota Works becoming a central contractor, and I've got an enlarged version of that here in front of me. But in essence, what we're suggesting is that the 270 providers of services to adults with disabilities, rather than contracting directly with the state of Minnesota, this central organization, again, that we're calling MinWorks in your packet, would be the contractor. They would have the contract between a county, let's say, or a school district, or maybe the city of St. Cloud, as an example. And then we would go find the providers that would be able to provide the appropriate services. Hopefully, a lot of these placements would result in long-term employment for the person with a disability. You know, if it's with the state of Minnesota, once they're placed, the state of Minnesota could put them on their payroll. We're just trying to do anything we can so that we can get our foot in the door as this provider community to expand the opportunity for all the people that these folks are serving. Right now, it is inconceivable, really, for all 270 of those organizations, especially some of the smaller outstate organizations, to keep track of the state register and bid on the work on a regular basis. Likewise, it would be very expensive for the state to let contracts, maybe it takes 5 or 6 or 7 providers to meet the need of a certain contract, rather than the state spending all that money contracting with those organizations individually. This is an opportunity for us to have that contract run through Minnesota Works, so it would save the state quite a lot of money. With us today are folks who are really interested in seeing this planning grant go forward. So with that, I'll close and let them speak as well.
Okay. Mr. Chair, we have Bill Harris, who works for
WORC.
Yeah, Winona ORC, WORC, he's the executive director of WORC. Winona ORC can share some thoughts with you.
Welcome,
Mr. Thank you, Senator Dibble. Chair Tomasoni and members of the committee. I am, for the record, Bill Harris, Executive Director of Winona ORC Industries. We're a nonprofit rehabilitation center, provides employment and support services to 330 people with disabilities on a daily basis. Our mission is to provide jobs, training, placement into business for a wide range of people with disabilities, developmental disabilities, mental illness, physical disabilities. Our major challenge is to find work for those people that do. And as a the government sector can and does provide a broad array of work that can be performed by people with disabilities. In looking at this over the, actually over a fairly lengthy period of time, I want to say that we're a member of the State Association Macro, and in the process of looking at how to provide more employment, Macro has determined that the government sector certainly is a major potential source of employment. So, again, as Lynn pointed out very ably, the major challenge is how do you find and make the connections, interim or intermediary nonprofit like Minnesota Works can smooth that process by facilitating the communication between the state of Minnesota and other governmental entities and the many potential employers at the community level like my organization.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, we have Pam Baltus, who's a program director at Wakosa up in central Minnesota. For those of you who have to know, because I did, Wakosa is a contraction of the first two letters of the communities of Waite Park, Cold Springs, and Sauk Rapids.
See, I never would have asked. That's good information. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Laura wanted to know last night. That was for her benefit.
For the record, I am Pam Baltus. I'm a program director for Wakosa. We are day training and habilitation as well as extended employment in St. Cloud, Sauk Center area. We have five different programs, and we serve over 400 individuals seeking employment and supports similar to Bill's program. I've been involved in this process and the research process over the last year, and I'm very familiar with the project, and one of the things that's exciting for me is that as a smaller organization in outstate, a lot of things that we could possibly do or bids that may come out from the state are just too big for us. We wouldn't be able to have the capacity to even bid, and by having this centralized entity who can do that and split that contract out among a variety of agencies, it really allows us to get in the game and play. So that's really exciting for us. Again, as part of the committee looking at this, one of the things that we'll be doing with this appropriation over the next 18 months is to really lay down the foundation for that nonprofit, that entity, to stand for our folks in the Minnesota area with disabilities to seek employment. And any questions, I guess we can get her at this point, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dibbler, is this state buying services, it's kind of like a central organization. Is there a cost for putting out the RFPs and or whatever it is you have to do to get the products to wherever they're going to go?
Let's hear from the department.
Right. Mr. Chair, we have someone from the Department of Administration who can probably answer that better than I could.
Knows the answer to that, right? Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brenda Willard, and I work for the State of Minnesota Department of Administration. I am the acquisitions manager. Basically, we post any solicitation required by law, over 25,000 on our website, so that any company or entity like this can respond to our bids, proposals, and there is no cost to respond to any of our solicitation documents.
Any questions from the committee? Any further comments, Senator Dibble? As long as you waited this long.
Yeah, so, Mr. Chair, we need, because we waited so long, the meter was ticking, and so I think, we'll need the full amount.
Okay. Then we'll lay Senate file 1030 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you all very much. Appreciate it. Another very patient individual.
have the one.
Senator Koch, this saw the last hearing ended, too.
Pardon me?
This saw the last hearing ended, too, just the other way around.
Yes, just we were on opposite ends of the table.
Yep.
Mr. Chair and member or two of the committee, I think the only logical place to start with this bill is page one, line one, and we'll just walk you through it.
I should do that, yes.
Talk about patience. No,
these guys are over here going, what next?
Everybody's got time, right? No. Mr. Chair, what I'd like to maybe first start doing... Okay, we're going to hold off. I've got an amendment, and we're making some copies, is my understanding. So, you know, I think what I'll first start with is the bill is the department's bill, and we have actually heard presentations, and we're going to hear some more on Friday, of most of, actually, pretty much everything that is in this bill. And so I'll just point out some things. I think this bill represents, and while it might not have everything that everybody wants, or, you know, it's heavier in other areas and lighter in some areas, this bill really represents a good balance. I think the departments really went out. Senator Dibble, we talked about the housing portion of it at great length, and although it doesn't have everything that we heard earlier with Senator Torres Reyes for the Housing Trust Fund, they also had to look at different programs that they additionally have to fund, rental assistance for the mentally ill, homeownership assistance fund, affordable rental investment fund, and so they found a way to get some good increases. They found some, I think, some really reasonable and good ways to use one-time money. There's money in here for renewable energy. There's money in here for, you know, there's money in here for the biosciences. We've heard a lot of that. There's the UEL in here, the Bioscience Alliance. I don't believe the nanotechnology, but there's money available. There's money for the Board of Arts. Would I maybe like some more? Perhaps. But there's other things to be considered. The Historical Society is in here. There's protection of the historical flags down in the Capitol area, the Rotunda area. And that's why I wanted to present this bill. I think it's due some good consideration, and our bill will be fashioned somewhat differently, I suspect, but there it is. So, you know, I'm not sure what you want to do. If you want the departments to come in and do some highlighting, we are, like I said, we are waiting on a bit of an amendment here. But would you like me to discuss the amendment?
We'll do that in a second. Senator Koch, are these numbers, including the governor's latest supplemental, did you know if anything changed in here?
I don't believe this bill includes the supplemental numbers. No, this.
Does anybody know that over there? I don't even know if he. I didn't look at the press release close enough to know if he actually changed our division at all.
Mr. Chairman, members, Paul Moe, Department of Employment and Economic Development. I don't know the governor's supplemental budget. This is not incorporated here. No.
It's not. Okay. All right. Okay. Okay, then you're going to have an amendment that's going to strip out some policy. Is that what it is?
Right. The amendment actually makes this bill much smaller. We'll take out a large portion. It's also included in Senate File 998, which is carried by Senator Scheid, and it will replace it with this, which is the only – basically, it takes the construction codes and licensing, all those changes, takes out all the policy, and leaves in only the fee structure changes. And so that's what my amendment is going to do. And we have the department here is also to discuss those if we'd like to even talk about the fee changes.
Does anybody want to testify on this at all or make any comments on Senator Saxock? Oh, okay. Because I'm wondering.
No, it's interesting.
Senator Koch, no, you want the because I'm trying to figure out if we actually need to take the policy out of this if it's already moving in another bill with Senator Scheid. Do you want to move some policy here?
Senator Thomasoni, what I just don't want to do is, you know, I think that there's some really good budget issues in here, and I would hate to see the policy portion of that holding up any of these budget items. So that's where I'm coming from.
But is your intent to move you want to move the, I think all the policy that's in here is in Senator Scheid's bill, isn't it?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay, and so, and since that's moving on its own, I mean, do you want a parallel track with this, or doesn't that matter to you?
Well, you know, I would prefer to pull it out, but if these budget items can still move forward for consideration.
I think my point is that if we pull it out and move it out of the committee, that's one thing. But if we just pull it out just to pull it out, then it's kind of a moot point. So I don't know. What does the department have an opinion on?
John.
I think we're doing it for a reason, but I'm not sure what. Go ahead.
Let's see.
Members of the committee, John Rakowski with Labor and Industry. The reason we prepared this amendment was because of the your budget deadline, quite frankly. The Senate file 998, which is Senator Scheid's bill, has to make a stop at the Judiciary Committee next Tuesday because there's an extensive enforcement article in here. And because the bill couldn't come to you in its entirety in order for you to meet your Monday deadline, that's why we thought we would pull out all the, as she said, all the fiscal and fee changes so that you could consider that for your budget markup on Monday. The bill then, Senator, you heard this bill, I think, just 2 days ago, and so after Judiciary, it would be referred to your Finance Division.
Okay, but it's already moving. We don't necessarily have to move it out of this bill in order to get it back here from Judiciary, is what I'm...
No, but we don't want to hold up for the deadline purposes, Mr. Chair. We don't want to hold up the budget portions of the bill.
Okay. All right. So Senator Koch moves that. The A070190 amendment.
Correct. And there's, Mr. Chair, there's one small change on page 18 of this, and we can probably just incorporate that in the amendment if Council feels that's all right. Page 18, line 5, it should read, except that subdivisions 1, 3, and 16, effective July 1st, 2007. Just subdivision 16 needs to be added there.
We'll incorporate that into the 0190 amendment. So with that, Senator Koch moves the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion adopted. Okay.
Thank you.
Then with that, then we will lay both of these on the table, and or one will be possibly included in the omnibus bill, and one possibly won't be. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. And any other comments, Mr. O'Rourke, where are you? I think we have another meeting on Friday morning at 9 a.m. and at 10 a.m. Okay, and it's in room 112, right? Okay, so we'll be meeting on Friday morning at 10 a.m. in room 112. I think we have a few more bills to hear, and I believe we'll probably be rolling out an article on ongoing funding for our departments and whatever programs are in the department. So you should be able to see what we're thinking about doing for Monday, okay? So meeting adjourned. Yeah.